great team here to tell our story. You'll hear about our strategy, various initiatives, and the technology and the innovation that drive our businesses. At the end of the event, I am confident you will share our excitement. But as excited as I am, I must admit I do have one disappointment here as we got ready for this event. Hopefully you all had a chance to take a look at the table materials outside. Had a lot of our business products, pictures of applications, some videos. So a lot of good stuff out there. But one disappointment. Apparently, the hotel has a rule that you cannot bring a Tomahawk cruise missile up here with one of our thermal batteries in it. So aside from that, we think we've got a great event planned, and we're excited for you to see it. Three quick housekeeping items I wanted to cover. I wanted to point out on slide one, we've got our safe harbor statement, so you want to take a quick look at that when you get a chance. Also wanted to make a few remarks about Q&A. We will do Q&A at the end of each individual speaker presentation and, again, at the end of the event. So please, we encourage your questions. Purpose of today is to really educate you about the business, so please ask as many questions as you can. We'll have people floating around the room with microphones to flag them down and go ahead and ask your questions at the end of each session. Also, we're going to take a break, a short 10-minute break, probably around 10:45 after the Magnetic Technologies presentation. We'll take a short break, and then we'll reconvene. There is Wi-Fi here in this room. If you want it, I'm going to read off the ID and the password. The ID is Investor Day. That's two words. And the password is OM Group 2014. OM Group would be in all caps, and it's all one word, OM Group 2014. If you have any questions, you can see Mary Lou in the back of the room there. But that's how to get onto the Wi-Fi if you need it. My last remark, my door is always open. At this point, I know a whole lot of you and have met a few more today. So please feel free to contact me anytime with questions. I'd be happy to talk to you about the company here. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Joe Scaminace.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for being here. It's really a great pleasure for me, and you know, I could share in Rob's comments about being so excited. We waited a long time for this day, a long time to be able to explain a transformation that, quite frankly, there was never a doubt in my mind when I joined OM in 2005 that we would be able to transform this company. We had great confidence in being able to do it. And I will tell you that similarly, that great confidence I had when I came in about transforming the company, I have greater confidence today that this inflection point that we're at is a new launching pad for a great future for this company. And I think you'll find today that with the meeting participants, that you're going to feel the same way at the end of this day. I'd like to just start out by sharing the participants. In your appendix, you will see the backgrounds of the individuals that are here today. And one of the interesting things about my journey with OM is that there's very few people that are here today that were with me when I joined the company. As we transformed away from commodities, we began to think more about high technology, more about value creation. And the executives that are here today are going to share with you a lot of what their experiences are. And, you know, I brought the biographies, and you know, just to mention how excited I am to have this team around me, David Knowles, as our President and Chief Operating Officer, has an incredible track record of success and a great background in terms of creating value. You know, David's knowledge, you know, comes from companies like Myers. He's got an engineering degree with a business degree on top of that. Actually worked under Larry Bassidy at Honeywell, had experience with HANA. And I know you could read all this, but I wanted to tell you all this because in the short time David's been with us, he's already been creating a lot of action out there in the field in terms of what we need to do to improve our margins, really move in the direction of innovation. And I'm just so excited. And, of course, a lot of you have met Chris Hicks. Chris was brought in as our new Chief Financial Officer. And I've traveled extensively with Chris, you know, from Boston to New York to Portland to San Francisco and Denver. And I will tell you that Chris's background with Robbins and Myers and Roper is noted out there by a lot of our investor base. You know, when we walk into a meeting, people will say, hey, Chris, I remember, you know, what happened when you began your journey at this other company. So, you know, the important thing about the executives that we have, and I know that the decisions that you need to make when you look at companies that have a bright future, is to look at the passion, the tenacity, the track record of the leadership. And that's not all. You know, we've got Greg Griffith, who's been with the company for a number of years. Greg has a great track record with us of creating and helping create these platforms that we have in the company. Rob Pierce, as you know, in investor relations, you know, Rob has a degree out of Notre Dame. But, you know, his background in financial analysis with EY is just really noteworthy. And then our leaders. You're going to be hearing from our leaders. Dr. Isola, you know, a couple questions out in the lobby out there were about automotive. Well, you know, we're talking about an individual who grew up in Stuttgart, Germany, who could tell you whether you ought to be buying an Audi or a Mercedes right now. He's really got it down. He's great at it. And then, of course, Randy Moore, who has a strong background as an Air Force lieutenant, understands the defense business, and Chris Vitale and Devlin Riley, who have been with us for a number of years. So that really lines up the people that you're going to be hearing from today. You know, one of the things I want to share with you is you know, some thoughts I had as I was sitting out on my patio in 2005. I have to take you back to that day, because that was really the day that when I joined OM and I was thinking about the dilemma that existed in the company. And I know a lot of you that knew OM back then and followed OM dealt with, tried to understand the idea of how we were impacted by commodity prices. You know, there was all this talk of and I don't even want to go into the terms of what was going on with over the metal, under the metal, how it affected the models that you tried to create in our company were as difficult as the models we tried to create when I joined the company. So what was in my mind on a Sunday morning, I remember thinking about it, and I was thinking about what always drove me. And this is a real simplification of what goes on in business in the world, and it really is an idea of our strategy. And this is an exact slide that I presented to the board of directors early in my tenure with OM, and it really explains the company. It explains what we're trying to do. Every business has a rightful owner. There's no doubt about it. And we clearly were not the rightful owners of commodity businesses. I mean, if you think about nickel and copper and platinum and palladium and aluminum, you have to have critical mass. OM did not have critical mass. We were, and let's look at the pyramid as life forms in the world that exist. And the lowest form of life that could exist in the business world is a commodity company with no critical mass. Another way to look at it, think about if you were a toller and you were just tolling products. The only thing you have to sell is price. That's all you could do. You go out there, you've got no competitive advantage. OM Group had no advantage. Leadership got rewarded by something that was way beyond their control. If metal prices went up, people got paid. If metal prices went down, the company had a bad year and the investors were punished. How do you live a life like that at the lowest form of that life? If you move up the scale, you then begin to see how pricing, how margins improve, relationships with customers, technology, confidence, and ultimately your investment returns get better. And when you think about what we've tried to do with the company as we began to transform, we tried and we're continuing to try to move up this platform here where the second rung of differentiated technologies or services is something that you need to look at and see how we've done that. Then you move up higher and you have a special technology or service, and then a dominant technology or service, or let's say a very proprietary one. And then in the ultimate control, you have, you know, a relationship with your end users. You know, the classic example is, you know, the now Dell doesn't do it anymore, but they had great technology, but they distributed it themselves to the end users. And ultimately, when you look at our company and what everything you're going to be hearing today, you're going to be looking at this framework and hearing about how product lines have technology. You're going to be hearing about innovation. You're going to be hearing about how we do have patented technology, because ultimately this is what's going to drive returns. So as part of our journey and part of my journey with this company, this next slide basically shows what we've been able to do. The yellow bar across shows the acquisitions, and the bottom one shows the divestitures. I just want to share with you, you know, in 2007, we sold our nickel business to Norilsk, if you recall. But what's more important is the acquisition of Borchers that we made in 2008. This model, even though it was a small acquisition, is a model for the future of our company, because what we acquired in Borchers was European technology that we launched through U.S. distribution, and it worked. We basically took paint drying technology. We had relationships with PPG, with Behr, with Masco, with Sherwin-Williams, and we were able to take paint drying technology and launch it and create greater demand and higher margins for our product line. The Rockwood acquisition that we made gave us exposure to geography and electronic chemicals in Asia. In the Eagle Pitcher acquisition, and, you know, it's really interesting, and you're going to hear from Randy today, you know, the Eagle Pitcher acquisition, we were absolutely adverse to buying anything that could get commoditized. We're so sensitive to the cobalt and nickel pricing that we said we do not want to be in electric car batteries. We knew that people were talking about EV and hybrid electric vehicles, but as we all know, that those batteries and all the capacity that was being built by Johnson Controls and A123 would quickly commoditize that business. So the attraction of Eagle Pitcher, we had knowledge of lithium ion, we had knowledge of what we wanted to do in that pyramid to move up a technology pyramid. And so what you're going to see in Eagle Pitcher is a business that's created very specialized, niche, higher-margin technology going into the battery space. And from this perch that they're on right now, we could launch in a lot of different directions, but always in the area of higher technology, higher margin, and growth. The VOC acquisition that occurred really gave us highly customized products and magnetic technologies. And as you'll see, VOC really breaks down into three specialized businesses in permanent magnets, cores and components, and materials and parts. And then, of course, the Rahu acquisition. And then ultimately, the breakthrough year, which I'll talk about in a minute, was 2013, when we sold our cobalt business and the UPC business. So this next slide shows the resulting portfolio as a result of what we were able to do. And here again, you know, this exposure to attractive markets has given us a sustainable and now more predictable model going forward. You could see that, you know, our whole goal, and again, think about the pyramid, is to become a technology solutions provider. So, you know, for those of you who are wondering about our return of capital ideas right now, we initiated this dividend. But strategically, the idea now is to build out these platforms, to become more of a solutions provider, and to take our component supply and figuring out a way to add either geographies, technology, and new products to expand our margins and returns. We have attractive markets, and we gave EBITDA guidance for the first time last year, I think, which was a big deal for us, a big deal for everyone. When you look at our share price ranges, it really gives you an idea of the game plan really working. You know, if you go back to 2009 and you look at a equity price range of $12 to $35 roughly, you know, I will tell you that that is totally correlated to the price of cobalt. When the stock hit 12 bucks, cobalt prices were down around $11 when the recession hit in 07. When the stock price went back up, cobalt prices were up at a higher level. So you could look at those ranges and totally correlate them to metal prices. When you look at 2014 and you look at the narrowing of that range, it's totally due to, and the valuation of our company, to a strategy that's becoming coherent, markets that are growing, and innovation and profitable growth plans of our company. And we plan on continuing that, and I think you're going to see a lot more stability, predictability, and growth in our portfolio. So I want to just put the company in perspective for you today. And just real basic numbers. You know, we're a billion-dollar company. We'll be over $1 billion in 2014. We hit our EBITDA guidance last year of $121 million of EBITDA. We have zero debt. We have cash on the balance sheet, which gives us flexibility. And believe me, trust us to be very good balance sheet managers. You know, we continue to have strong goals in terms of our working capital as a percent of sales, but we also are looking at our balance sheet to give us the ability to return value in the form of a stronger company and the recent announcement of our dividend. If you look at our company, the way it breaks out, the majority of our revenue comes out of magnetic technologies. Specialty chemicals and battery technologies are also represented, and we've got a $1 billion market cap. So when you look at our vision, you know, this really gives you the highest level vision of our company. We are a technology-driven industrial company focused on high-value markets. We aspire to, and every one of our leaders is augured into this vision, to have a lean, decentralized organization with the best talent in our industries, driven by a culture of excellence in innovation, operations, and leadership, creating customer loyalty with high-quality products and technology while consistently growing our profits and delivering value through acquisitions and that deliver strong returns. Ultimately, this vision will create value. So looking to 2013, you know, this was clearly a breakthrough year for us. You know, I won't go over all of these. You could read them directly yourself. But some of the highlights, you know, David Knowles was brought on early in the year as our new president and chief operating officer. We divested our UPC business, which is a commodity play for us. We had positive quarterly results throughout the year. We added a brand new board member in the year, Carl Christensen, who added another dimension to our governing body of really strong independent directors that are providing great guidance for our growth as we move forward. And we initiated a dividend early this year. So the enterprise objectives in 2014 really break down into the following. You know, we are a company that has 6,000 families that depend on us, that we want our workers and all of our employees going home in the same condition that they came to work. We have a strong safety culture in our company. And if you go back and correlate safety with productivity and value, you'll find that there's a strong correlation there. And we believe that zero accidents are a very important part of our culture. We continue to drive a culture of innovation and excellence to improve our growth with a focus on margins and returns. You're going to be hearing from David Knowles and our business leaders and Chris Hicks. And this whole idea of our enterprise objectives, is you're going to be hearing about things like commercial excellence, innovation excellence, that we're going to continue to launch new technology, but we're also going to look and delve into our product lines and look at the product lines that are not creating value and figuring out a way for them to create more value, which really means that we're going to be driving our margins. We're going to expand and have already expanded our leadership training and talent development programs, and we're aggressively pursuing acquisitions. And Greg is going to talk about our M&A strategy today and, of course, the initiation of our dividend. So to wrap things up, this really gives you an idea of our strategic, business, and financial alignment. Our enterprise vision, which I just talked about, the key initiatives being growth, innovation, commercial, and operations excellence, and ultimately the outcomes of our efforts will be profitable growth, expanded margins, continuing the efficiency of our balance sheet, attractive deployment of our capital, and improved returns, creating a high-performing investment for all of our investors. So at this point, I know that I have a question slide here, but I know that you want to hear from our leadership team. I will be here the entire time. Any questions that you'd like to direct to me, I would be more than glad to answer. And at this point, I'd like to turn over the podium to our Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, Chris Hicks.
Thanks, Joe. Well, thanks, Joe, and thanks, everyone, for attending our first-ever Investor Day. It's a pleasure to see all of you. We appreciate you investing some of your capital and your intellectual capital with us here today as well. Slide's not up there. You're going to see this slide appear a couple of times in our presentation, and it's not by accident or by coincidence here. We've got a management team that's fully aligned around a vision that Joe laid out for you. It's a vision that addresses our key constituencies, so making sure that we've got a terrific workforce, we've got very satisfied customers, and we've got delighted investors. We've got a strategy that's been rolled out and a vision rolled out throughout the entire enterprise, one that's embraced by our entire group, one that we think will deliver the financial outcomes that Joe mentioned, profitable growth, higher returns, better balance sheet measurement, and ultimately a high-performing investment for our shareholders. A lot of you I've known over the years. We've been involved together in the industrial and chemical space generally, and so a fishbone diagram is something that is not a surprise to any of you folks here. We are a continuous improvement shop. There's a lot of things that we can do to continue to deliver on a high-performing investment, and it really stems around our ability to be good stewards of capital and to make sure that we maximize the returns on the investments that we put to work inside of our company and for acquisitions that we do. And I think that's evidenced by some of the improvements we've made over the last few years. We did a terrific job cutting $17 million of costs out of the enterprise in addition to the usual continuous improvement efforts. We put a new credit agreement in place to support the M&A program. We returned capital to shareholders in the form of a share repurchase. And at the same time, we prepared ourselves and ultimately implemented a regular quarterly cash dividend this year. So there's been a lot of great work throughout the enterprise, all of it as we develop our financial acumen, discipline, and capabilities throughout the company. So Joe gave you a bit of a snapshot on what the company looks like today, $1 billion of revenue and so forth. I wanted to give you a little bit more of a trend line of the company's performance. If you look at the sales line, and what we've done is we've stripped out the cobalt business and all of this, but what you can see is growth from 11 to 12 as we brought on the full year of the VOC performance, and then continued growth as we went into 2013. Now, there's a little bit of a bubble in there for the rare earths that we have been talking about the last few years, not so much now as prices have stabilized, but factoring out that rare earth bubble, we had a little bit of growth in 2013. More importantly, looking at the profitability side of the picture on the right-hand side, you can see how EBITDA grew last year, achieving our EBITDA guidance range. And for the second year in a row, we've provided guidance again. So we're guiding toward $130 to $140 million of EBITDA for 2014. And that range really depends on a couple of things. We've got a lot of terrific initiatives, some of which you're going to hear about today. And also, we're a little bit tied to the macroeconomic activity in Europe, being about exposed to about half of our business over there. And we're also exposed a little bit to the U.S. government spending for defense and other aerospace applications. So we'll continue to watch those macro drivers to see how they impact our performance. Most recently, we've also enjoyed a nice growth in our margins. This growth has come from a variety of initiatives across the enterprise, some of it being growth-driven, and some of that being driven more by the cost reductions. If we take out $17 million of cost, it doesn't take a lot of high math to figure out that adds over a point and a half of margin. So it's a terrific contributor to performance in 2013. We do get a question from time to time. Folks want to know what the capabilities are. How far can we drive margins? We want to set it up in a very simple way, which we think we can grow this portfolio about 5% over the course of a business cycle. And we've got contribution margins that are about 30% or so. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of how margins can expand as we grow. It doesn't give you as much of an indication of some of the continuous improvement and other actions that David's leading throughout the enterprise, which will be make further contributions to our performance. But we know that the game on returns is not just about the numerator on the profit side. It's also about the denominator. We got to manage the balance sheet. As Joe mentioned, we're terrific managers of the balance sheet. We've got an incredible focus on that. We've made some really good strides in managing net working capital. We measure that as a function of sales, which we think is a good way to look at efficiency. And as you go from 11 to 13, there's been a couple ups and downs along the way. But overall, we've driven the enterprise down into the low 30s. And we think there's an opportunity this year to take a few more points out. And, of course, the reward for that will be taking out more points in the future as well. On the CapEx side of things, we've got a terrific program in place for how we evaluate and allocate capital, how our businesses compete for capital, all around the idea of generating good returns. It's been a really good back and forth with our businesses as we harmonize our strategy against our desire to be excellent stewards of capital. And this year we've got a little bit of a bump. We're investing in some terrific new growth initiatives in some of our businesses and doing a little bit of infrastructure improvement in our magnetic technologies platform. Going forward, we think we can take that CapEx as a percent of sales down to 4% or lower, and we'll always have good tension and good reviews of all of our capital requests that come up from the businesses. So OM Group's been known as a terrific free cash flow generator over time. We've got a chart up there that shows you the operating cash from 2013. We expect cash flow to be even higher in 2014. Well, between that and not having any debt on the balance sheet and having some cash gives us a high-class problem about what to do with it. And I can tell you that we're very thoughtful in everything that we do, and our key priority is always going to be to support the businesses that we have. So you're going to hear from the four of our business leaders here today, and that's our primary objective with allocating capital to make sure that we build out those terrific platforms. That's primarily supporting their internal initiatives, but also our synergistic acquisition program. And we've got enough cash flow and capacity to where we can also support the return of capital, which, again, we initiated our first ever dividend, our first dividend in many years, just recently. Looking at the capital structure of the company, well, today we sit here with a lot of cash and no debt. We understand that, you know, over time, there's an opportunity to invest that. We assure you that we are good stewards of capital. We look very carefully at generating good returns in the businesses. But I also wanted to highlight for you the chart on the right side of the page. And what that shows you is, especially the gold part of it there, is when we had a commodity business and the prices could change very quickly in the cobalt world, we had to maintain a tremendous amount of cash around the world just to support working capital needs. And as we sold off that business, the amount of float cash we need to maintain has come down significantly. So it's one of the benefits we get, one of the many benefits of migrating from a commodity business to a business with much more of a technology and innovation orientation. Looking at our leverage capabilities here, and I know we've got a couple of our bank friends in the room as well, so I'm sure they'll be happy to hear that we intend to manage the leverage of the company in a very prudent way. We think 1 to 2 times leverage is the sweet spot for the company. We think that'll generate a mature capital structure, one that rewards all of our investors, equity, and the lenders as well equally. And if we do that, and we do that the right way, we have a tremendous amount of capacity for supporting both internal development programs as well as our acquisition program. And we can invest up to $600-700 million. Now, I want to assure you, if for some reason we decide to push the leverage beyond the 1 to 2 times sweet spot, we'll only do that, as we've done in the past, if we have a very clear roadmap and a confidence for how we quickly get that back into the 1 to 2 times range. So in summary, it's a terrific company. We've got a great vision, a great strategy, a full alignment with the management team and through all of our businesses on how we're going to grow profitably and generate better returns, be excellent stewards of capital, and ultimately produce terrific value for our shareholders. So with that, I'm going to open it up to any questions that you might have.
Hi, I'm Mike Harrison with First Analysis. On your fishbone diagram there, you mentioned the improved capital allocation process. I was wondering if you could just give us a sense of how you look at capital spending, how maybe what your hurdle rates are, and how you would look at internal growth opportunities or organic opportunities versus acquisitions.
Okay. Yeah, so the question is around our capital allocation process and some of the discipline around that and hurdle rates and so forth. What I can tell you is that when you live in a commodity world and you can't predict the price of cobalt the next day, it makes it very difficult to allocate capital, to make long-term decisions. Now that we're in a world that's much more predictable and consistent, it's much easier for us now to make longer-term investments and plans with our businesses. I can tell you that we've had the opportunity to harmonize the way we look at capital allocation across all of our businesses, and we do believe that every program that we initiate will cover its cost of capital within 3 to 5 years and, you know, hopefully quicker. We think our cost of capital is somewhere between 11 and 12%, maybe not today or with low-cost debt, but we tend to look at this in a longer-term basis, assuming interest rates will return to more longer-term sustainable levels. And so that's the challenge we put in front of all of our businesses, is to cover that cost of capital.
You know, I would also add, though, Mike, that from a, you know, capital allocation standpoint, within the businesses themselves, you know, we've created a culture where we are challenging our business leaders to absolutely be the champions of their capital and to have to absolutely forecast sales and or if it's cost or if it's a new project or a new customer. So as Chris mentioned, it's a lot easier to do it when we have a business where we have technology and real customers out there that we could analyze.
Thanks, Chris. You talk here in the slide 21, Alan Matrani from Sylvan Lake Asset Management, by the way. It says acquired EBITDA at 7 to 9 times multiple. I know it's just for illustrative purposes. It seems like we're hearing from a lot of industrial companies and everybody that's a hard barrier to hit nowadays. with people willing to lever up a lot higher than you are. Can you talk about how you're going to get that build-out platform and scale in today's M&A world?
Sure. So what I'm going to do is defer the answer to most of that question to Greg Griffith, our head of M&A, when he makes his presentation. I think he'll get a good sense for that. The only thing I would tell you is that we're absolutely committed to sticking by our guns on this and maintaining our discipline. We have not actually gotten a transaction completed in the last couple of years, and it's not because we're not working on it. We're just maintaining our discipline for returns, and sometimes you've got to let them go.
Thanks. I'm sure we'll have more M&A questions later. But in terms of the cost structure, as you look at it from a CFO, where do you see, you know, maybe some specific opportunities on the existing businesses to perhaps be more efficient?
You know, with respect to the cost structure, I want to contrast 2013 with 2014. As we entered 2013, we recognized that we had an opportunity across the businesses, including in the corporate office, to remove some big chunks of cost. So we made that commitment. We achieved that commitment. But we're much more of a continuous improvement type company. So when David Knowles gets a chance to talk, you'll hear more about how we drive the enterprise, really one step at a time. And I think you'll see us managing our cost structure in more of a continuous improvement sort of approach.
Demetrius Silverstein with Longbow Research. Having initiated dividend, can you talk a little bit about what your dividend payout policy would be as far as percent of, you know, current year or last year's earnings or some other metric that we can look for to try to model your dividend increases going forward?
So the question's about dividend policy, and having just gotten started with it, we want to give this a little bit of time to develop and mature, as you can appreciate. But listen, I think the main message for us is we're committed to being able to return some capital to shareholders while at the same time primarily executing on the growth strategy with the primary focus around building out our business platforms, supporting these great business leaders we have here, and adding on some terrific businesses that can help make the platforms even stronger. Okay. Terrific. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Greg Griffith now to lead a discussion on the M&A side. Greg?
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see some familiar faces. It's been a while. My opportunity is to talk about our mergers and acquisitions program at OM Group, and it's a great time to focus on that topic. I will tell you, as someone who was here when Joe arrived, that with Joe came a vision for the company and an alignment of the company and where it was going, and that alignment and that focus has allowed us to stay really focused on our objectives to exit away from the commodity platforms and to create the growth platforms that we have today. And that unwavering focus has also enabled us to move down the line without a lot of twists and turns and to stay really focused on what our objectives were. We have successfully exited what was at the time the commodity platforms that OM Group had at the time, and I think have been successful establishing legitimate growth platforms that enable us to deliver the attributes that you've heard Joe and Chris talk about. And the shift that really has occurred is while initially focusing on exiting the commodity businesses and establishing the growth platforms, what we've also done is now move mergers and acquisitions more into a focus that it becomes an important component of our growth platform so that it is not the single driving force that it was initially, as we were exiting the platforms. It's now a very, very important component of our future growth plan. By now, you've heard from Joe, Chris, and Rob of the criteria that we apply to every acquisition opportunity, and I don't know that I need to repeat everyone verbatim, but I will tell you that the mantra that you hear from those guys is a mantra that is often repeated internally, and it's one that is shared and owned by everyone in the organization, so that any opportunity that emerges from the business leaders to my right that you'll be hearing more from, any opportunity that emerges meets the criteria that you see in front of you today and the criteria that you've heard about in the past. Obviously, it has to be technology-driven. We're in technology businesses, and therefore the opportunities are going to supplement that technology portfolio. Obviously, we need to look at how it enhances our leadership positions in the markets we serve or the customers that we serve. And without a doubt, because we've all, for any of us who survived the days of the earnings volatility, we place a high premium on the sustainability and the earnings predictability that comes with technology-driven platforms. We also make sure that with every opportunity, and we'll talk about the process in a minute, but every opportunity that emerges comes with that a deal champion that comes out of the business unit. There's no better way than to make sure that an acquisition target is going to complement your existing business than if that business leader owns that opportunity and owns the results and the benefits that come as a result of it. It certainly helps track the integration planning, et cetera, but that deal champion is as critical as the opportunity itself. I don't know that OM Group's acquisition process is unique among the companies that make critical acquisitions on a routine basis, but what I do think is a real strength of the organization is the experience that we bring to bear up and down the organization and throughout the organization. As I said, it starts with the deal champion that defines and fully understands what the opportunity it is, but our process also draws on the experience across the organization, starting with business management, the corporate management, and even based on the size of the deal, engages our board of directors in terms of the significance to make sure that we're challenging at every turn of the evolution of an opportunity, not only the assumptions that we're making, but we understand the benefits that we expect to derive from completing that acquisition. But I think one of our real strengths is not only the understanding of the businesses, the potential of our businesses and our business leaders, but I also think we bring really outstanding business acumen and judgment in terms of capital allocation, et cetera. I would also mention that when we talk about the experience of the people in the organization, the one person who's not here that I do think bears singling out is Valerie Sachs, our general counsel, our vice president and general counsel. She's the first executive that Joe brought in after he arrived, and she's been part of every transaction that we've made. And I would also tell you, I would mention her even if I didn't know she was listening, but she hears everything we do. So I do want to single her out as well. You know, an important part of, in addition to diligencing the acquisitions and making sure that we value them correctly, is that discipline from an integration standpoint. And again, I think that having that deal champion is so critical to making sure that not only do we have a view of the business at the front side, but we have somebody who's going to own the outcomes of those transactions on the other side. And they understand that those assumptions are going to be tracked, challenged, and measured for a number of years afterwards, so that it's not simply a matter of just completing an acquisition, issue the press release, and then we forget about it. We make sure that we measure the returns on every dollar that we allocate long after the acquisition is done. When you take a look at the opportunities that exist today, we really do benefit from the cross-section of markets and industries that we serve with our growth platforms. As Joe talked about, whether it's our magnetic technologies platform, really our three discrete business areas, complementary businesses, but businesses that afford opportunities in and of themselves. In the case of the battery technologies platform, this is a rapidly growing, expanding area of new technology in terms of energy storage, energy management, as well as the battery technologies. And you're going to hear from Randy in a few minutes about his lithium-ion center of excellence that is being established at Eagle Pitcher in our battery technologies platform. And I would suggest to you that is a really unique opportunity that we stay very close to those trends in those markets, And there's been no shortage of opportunities that we've looked in that space. There are some really great technologies. In many cases so far, these are technologies whose day have not yet come, but we continue to monitor and assess those technologies and the opportunities that arise from that. I can assure you that across our businesses, we maintain and monitor a pretty rigorous set of targets, surfaced by our business guys, surfaced with inputs from third-party advisors that we track on a quarterly basis. In many cases, the opportunity that we identify may not be the opportunity that their current owners recognize, and so sometimes patience is required, discipline is required. In the case of our Borchers acquisition, we looked at that twice before we were able to actually complete an acquisition. And so part of that discipline is to make sure that you don't or that we don't try to complete an acquisition before it's time. I see by my by the timekeeper I need to wrap this up. So the in summary, I do think we have all of the components necessary to completing the kinds of additional growth and growth opportunities that come from a fully aligned acquisition program. I think we have the right balance between the discipline to do them the right way while understanding the strategic imperative that everybody on this dais, as well as everybody across our company, understand that we have an imperative to grow the business and to grow the business in the most intelligent, cost-effective way possible. And on that way, OM Group is as aligned today as it has ever been on how best to do that. With that, I'll open it up to any questions.
Rosemary Morbelli with Gabelli. Talking about growing the business, what do you expect organic growth to be versus M&A? And then looking at M&A, what is the likelihood of a large acquisition?
I better let Joe or Chris take care of the organic growth expectations.
Yeah, what we've talked about, Rosemary, is organic growth, you know, over the course of a business cycle, roughly around 5%. And the acquisition growth will be additive to that. You know, we're looking to build out these platforms in a very, very thoughtful way, you know, using the business leaders to identify that. So it's difficult to put a growth target on the acquisitions. I think when Greg talked about the typical deal size right now, you know, tend to be in the smaller areas where, you know, $10 million at the low end and perhaps somewhere between $150 to $200 million at the top end. But again, it'll be opportunistic. The likelihood of a large one being close to $200
million?
Being above $200 million? The likelihood is much smaller in that regard because, you know, we clearly don't want to do any bet-the-farm deals right now given where our portfolio is, and it would have to be a real blockbuster transaction that would be easily explainable, easily identifiable, with very low risk on the profit line.
You mentioned earnings predictability as being something that's very important. Sometimes you can have cyclical end markets that would suggest you might be able to predict the earnings. They might not necessarily be steady across the cycle. So how do you think about an acquisition like the VOC acquisition where you do have some cyclical exposure, some raw material volatility in there that maybe you can predict the earnings, but they're not necessarily steady? In the context of the 7X to 9X, you know, I know that those were just kind of assumptions thrown out there, but how much of a premium, I guess, are you willing to pay for something that does have a more stable, you know, defensive end markets with relatively low raw material volatility, or is that not necessarily what you're looking for?
You know, it's a great question, and it goes to the position that we're in right now. In the case of VOC, for example, earnings predictability wasn't at the start of the list. The technology, their leadership positions, the sustainability of the business, and their positioning in some of the mega trends that we saw at the time really drove us to that business. And we then also realized that with that came a much higher degree of predictability than what we've had in the past. But when you take a look at how VOC has aligned with really some of the important mega trends that are going on right now, and afford us the opportunity of a look forward with some real sustainable technologies all factored into the valuation. The other thing I'll say before Joe jumps in is that when you take a look at a business that perhaps in the hands of someone else may have had some earnings volatility, in our hands, by filling a gap that we might have in another part of our business, is a way to really balance out that and bring some more earnings profitability so that we don't exclude a target because perhaps in its current owner's hands it lacks some of that predictability. We see how it fits, complements, and what it's going to do for our existing businesses and how it's going to build out our platform.
You know, Mike, it's a good question. You know, take a look in the mirror of acquisition and look at a divestiture. When we decided to sell nickel, it would have been really great if we could have predicted the nickel price. We couldn't predict it. And, you know, it was one of those things where we knew we had to get out of it. It was a strategic decision. And I could tell you that our M&A program continues to be very strategic. You know, we're at the opposite end of what private equity would look at, you know, in terms of, you know, we think like private equity guys when it comes to cost and cash and balance sheet leadership, but we think about, you know, building value as a strategic enterprise here. So when these ideas come from our business leaders, you know, clearly we look at cyclicality. Clearly we look at predictability. But we're looking to build out a business that's going to be dynamic, that we're going to have confidence in our growth. And therefore, when we look at, you know, what the 7 to 9 or whatever, you know, it's a criteria but not the number one leading criteria for us.
It's amazing how much you can learn knowing how, when, and why to sell a business, how that factors into how, when, and why to buy a business. And so it's been instructive from the early days to now.
Good morning. Chris Capps with Topeka Capital Markets. Just a couple questions because in the context that you mentioned how critical and the acquisition strategy is to growth, Chris Hicks obviously touched upon the balance sheet capacity. But just against the context of Joe's comments about back to the pyramid and back towards shifting this portfolio towards differentiation and so forth, I'm just wondering, you know, in focus in wanting to get, you know, more predictability, more stability with the business, I guess also balance might be part of that. So I'm wondering how much that drives the process and are the targets, therefore, going to more likely be skewed towards the businesses that are smaller today, or might it be, you know, in VOC? And,
yeah.
And then on the 7 to 9 metric, it's just a clarification, is that intended to be a post-synergy metric?
Let me deal with the process, and I'll let Joe or Chris talk about the end result. Our target list is a big funnel, that we have opportunities being channeled in not only from our business leaders, but also from our advisors. I mean, any opportunity that is in our space, because I think the message is permeating sufficiently where OM Group is headed, that there's now a sufficient number of opportunities being brought to us by third parties as well. The really unique position that we're in today is there's enough opportunities coming into the funnel that we actually have choices between where best to allocate that capital and how best to drive the results as a result of that. And so that at any point along the way when we have multiple opportunities that could be going along at the same time, we can decide how best to value one versus another in that context. My job and the job of the business leaders and so forth is to define and identify the opportunities and the value, et cetera, for what those kinds of acquisitions are going to have. At the end, we take a look at the financial metrics to make sure that whether they're meeting the multiples that we've identified or not. But more importantly, is it's how we can compete with private equity. Is we can pay a higher multiple because of the synergies and because of the efficiencies that we drive out of these acquisitions. That's what puts us at the table with private equity. In terms of the 7 to 9 multiple, again, I'll leave it to Joe and Chris to address that.
Yeah, sure. I would say the 7 to 9 is going to be some blend between a trailing and a forward-looking multiple. It just depends on timing of the deal and when you get it completed within a fiscal year, that sort of thing. I think the key comment I want to respond to, though, as Greg mentioned, we have an advantage over some buyers because of the synergies we get as we build out the platforms. But the key is we don't necessarily want to pay for all the synergies. That's how we create values to capture a lot of the synergies for our investors.
Just one additional comment. You talked about this issue of balance. We don't sit around talking a lot about buying something because we need to better balance of the portfolio, we talk a lot about the strategy that we have in our businesses and acquisitions that help us accomplish something moving down that strategic path. So be it building out, Randy will talk about a lithium ion center of excellence. We're trying to build out a lithium ion center of excellence in the battery business, or enhance our global presence in the magnetic technologies business. Those really are the drivers of what we're looking at, as opposed to just sort of trying to keep something, you know, generally in balance.
And just to follow up, on page 28, you flesh out your integration process.
Sure.
and a lot of detail there, and appreciate that. But the question is you know, the acquisitions that you've done to date, for the most part, have been more the platform varietal, not you know, something that's going to be a bolt-on or complementary.
Sure.
To existing.
Sure.
Platform, outside maybe Borchers. So I'm just wondering, you know, just can you just talk about the, you know, the confidence you have in the ability to integrate what would be a more complementary acquisition with the, you know, the bandwidth that the company has, the organizational skill set that you have?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris.
Yeah.
When we talk about acquisitions, we look at products, product lines, technologies that may not show up on the radar screen of some of you in this room, but they are important adjuncts to the business that we have. So that our target list goes beyond just an entity that's sitting out there that we're going to incorporate into our own group. But with that said, my confidence goes up because, again, when we were building out the platforms, we had a criteria that big enough, broad enough to allow us to grow. Today, with the business leaders, with Joe, with David, with Chris, that integration plan is probably gets as much attention as the valuation, the due diligence process, so that we have probably defined and have scoped out in as great a detail what that integration plan is going to be before we execute the acquisition, so that those assumptions are defined. The people responsible for those assumptions have been assigned. And then if you look at this group of people to my right, I mean, that is precisely why my confidence level is high in our ability to integrate the acquisitions. And so, in fact, the closer it is to the businesses that we have and closer in the hands of the business leaders, there's probably a higher confidence in terms of our ability to integrate those acquisitions than at any time.
Chris, you know, and it is a great question, because if you think about the platform acquisitions that we did up to this point, had no synergy. I mean, we called them enabling, you know, and in doing the deals that we did, we were able to unlock the true value of the companies that we bought. So it was more of a financial unlocking of trapped value. Today, with David and the business leaders, we are absolutely honed in on this integration. Integration actually begins during due diligence. You know, questions like, how are we going to run this? Who's the leader? What are the synergies? Well, let's identify them. Are they market adjacencies? Are they cost synergies? Are we buying technology? Does it fit the strategy? Everything is focused on strategic development of a platform to grow our profits, grow our margin, return value. That's everything we're focused on. Might just add that the acquisitions that we're looking at today, or have been looking at and continue to look at, they're purpose-driven acquisitions. So if we were a commodity company, we'd probably have a one-size-fits-all integration approach.
Yeah.
To acquisitions, and it'd look a lot like, let's just squish it right into what we own already. Today, we're buying things for a purpose, so we'll have an integration plan that's customized for that specific opportunity that we're working on.
Okay, so if there's no other questions, I'd like to introduce David Knowles, our President and Chief Operating Officer.
Thank you, Joe. And I'd like to just say that Joe shared the vision of the company and the remarkable journey that we've taken to arrive at this vision that we have today. And I think he's conveyed the excitement that we as a team have for the opportunity that we face here in the future. Chris shared a little bit of our financial results and some of the recent strides that we're making. And in a minute, you're going to hear from the key operating team. With this team, the journey of continuing to build upon the success that we've had and continuing to build upon performance really goes on. In their presentations, you're going to see some details of some of the opportunities that we have and some of the important work that we need to get done to continue to drive the results and performance of the business. So this presentation focuses on how we look at our businesses on a company-wide basis, and particularly how we're going to focus on achieving Joe's vision. And we start by introducing four key initiatives, the four initiatives in the middle of this chart. In these four initiatives, you have what I would like to call the glue that binds these very diverse businesses. Our businesses are pretty diverse. They're all technology-driven businesses, so they share some common characteristics, but there's diversity amongst these as well. And these four things really form the glue that hold these diverse set of businesses together. So whether you're at a permanent magnet facility in Hanau, Germany, or you're at our testing lab for electronic chemicals in Shenzhen, China, or you're at a medical battery manufacturing facility up in Vancouver, you ought to be able to start seeing these four common characteristics across OM Group wherever you go. And those are growth and innovation, commercial and operations excellence, organization and leadership development, and financial excellence. And I'm going to describe these a little bit further in just a minute. But I'll just take a step here to talk about our businesses. We have a terrific portfolio. Chris has talked a little bit about our financial performance. And you can see that our performance in 2013 is starting to show what we've been talking about steadily improving the business. And in each of our businesses, despite some of the challenges that we saw in the market in 2013, we showed some improved profitability and returns. Just a couple quick highlights. After some of the volatility that Chris talked about in our raw material supply and the magnetic technologies business that really sort of finally worked its way through in 2012, our magnetic technologies business was able to deliver improved profitability in the face of a weak European market. Our battery technologies business combined a strong first half of the year defense sales and solid growth in its medical segment to turn in solid sales profit and return improvement in 2013. And in the midst of a weak European coatings and electronics market, our specialty chemicals businesses started to reap some of the benefits from our sharpened focus on value. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as we get into these businesses. And we're able to improve our profitability and returns. So as you look at these results, you can also see that there is plenty of opportunity for us to continue to improve our operating results. And in a few minutes, I think you'll see that all of our business leaders share that view. I think we all believe that we can continue to make this a better performing business. The opportunities and challenges are specific to each of the businesses, but we have a common commitment to continuing to improve our results. So, as I said, while all of our businesses are technology-driven industrial businesses, they can serve some diverse markets, and they can have some different drivers. And the process on this chart is really an overview of how we look at these businesses across this diversity that we have. It transcends that diversity and creates these common initiatives that we have. The first step in this overall process is strategic planning. I'm just going to describe this for a minute because it's an important part that kind of forms the basis of what we do in the business. Each of our business teams have a solid grasp of their products and markets. The OM Group approach is to raise the bar every year in strategic planning. We do a rigorous fact-based inquiry into the drivers in our markets and the source of competitive advantage. And in conjunction with this, we perform a drill down into the economics of each of our businesses, seeking to understand where we can capture real value improvement and where we need some corrective actions. The output of the process is a clear direction that's shared across the company, ownership of the business direction by the business owners throughout the business, and a concise set of strategic initiatives that we'll talk about at a high level in a couple of minutes, and then you'll get a chance to see in a more detailed way when the business leaders present their businesses. So the strategic plan leads to our operating initiatives. And there's four of these operating initiatives that we focus on that I described earlier. I'm going to speak first about growth and innovation. And I think what I'd like to first say is there's not a lot that we seeing in the corporate office can do to mandate growth and innovation in our businesses. We can't sit there and just say,
gosh, you need to grow this much faster, and it just happens. So what we do, though, is we can encourage it and we can foster it, and I'd like to talk about a couple of things that we do. The first thing that's critical, I think, in our business and how we look across the organization is that we structure our business in profit centers, and you'll see this as you'll hear more and more from the business leaders. We try to get ourselves so that our decision-making is close to the customer and that the customer's voice is loud in the overall decision-making process that we have on a day-to-day basis. We also set what we call an innovation environment and how we manage the company and we empower our employees. Innovation can come from anywhere within the company, and we want to make sure that people are heard. And this is one of the benefits of this decentralized structure that Joe mentioned earlier in his vision. The other thing we can do is we can introduce new tools and new ideas. We just introduced a methodology yesterday. We were at a conference where we talked about the very front end of the StageGate innovation process and how do we capture the customer's voice in a more disciplined way to create higher probability outcomes as we're doing research and development and product development through our processes. Another thing that we can do across the organization. And lastly, and almost just as important as the rest, we create an environment where we celebrate the successes that we have. And two nights ago, we had our first innovation awards that we gave out across the business. And in fact, I think innovation awards went to both the magnetic and the battery technologies platforms in our business. So an important part of creating and fostering that innovation culture. So the next part, we look at commercial excellence and operation excellence as continuous improvement processes. Commercial excellence is about making sure that our margins reflect the value that we're adding when we dedicate resources to our customers. This is a continuous improvement process, and we're focusing this year on developing the tools and taking action on a much more granular understanding of the profitability of our products and customers. Operations excellence is about continually improving the productivity of our operations so that we can achieve our industry's highest standards in safety, productivity and cost savings, quality and delivery. The third initiative is organization and leadership development. Really ask the question, do we have the right structure with the appropriate focus and the right accountability and incentives in place? Do we have the best talent in our industries in these positions? And do we give them the tools that they need to do their jobs effectively? And then we put this all together into continuously improving our financial performance through our financial excellence initiative. I think Chris has mentioned we're focusing on return on investment. We're focusing on the efficient use of working capital and fixed capital in our operations. And ultimately, a focus on the numbers throughout our business so people know what they're delivering against with performance. Let me just take a quick diversion for a second to kind of highlight the Commercial Excellence Initiative. This is sort of a look at how we drill down into our business to better understand our product and customer profitability at a much more granular level. And we find that there's opportunity across our business in doing this. It's a process of progressively drilling down into our portfolio of products and customers, directly applying costs at each level, and it can be a challenging exercise because sometimes the accounting systems don't lend themselves to do this, and that's why companies don't always do this. It's an opportunity for us to learn how we can create more value. But when we do it, it can be pretty revealing, and you can see in this example at a division level, you might see some standard results. But when you drill down by product line and then by product itself, you start to find a more granular understanding of where we make money and where our resources are better focused. And what this leads to are both strategic and tactical actions. Our strategic actions are where do we best put our resources, where we can get a good return from those resources. The tactical actions may be, gosh, if we're not getting the right kind of return in this market that we're pursuing or these product lines, there's something we can do around pricing. So that's kind of the overall approach. And a few recent actions based on this kind of work has been to carve out our Borchers Additives business. Devlin is here today as part of our Advanced Organics business. We've created a real focus on this now that we think is going to drive value. We're shifting resources inside of our electronic chemicals businesses to a place where we find that we add more value and have a better growth opportunity. And we have some tactical pricing actions that we're taking to try to improve the value that we get for what we're bringing to the market. This next page just talks at a high level about the strategic success factors that we have in the business, and I'll talk about these in general. You'll hear a lot more about them in a few minutes. But this is how we characterize where we're going in these different businesses. Magnetic technologies, it's improved performance and build the platform. We think we have a real growth opportunity both in innovating and products, the new applications, as well as expanding this business on a geographic basis, and we're working both of those. While at the same time, we're looking at how do we manage this cost structure for over time for greater competitiveness. We want to look and make selective acquisitions to build out magnetic technologies as well. Battery technologies is really about leveraging this technology that we have and building a broader commercial platform. Randy will talk about the Lithium Ion Center of Excellence, growing commercial applications, and then ultimately building a broader battery technologies platform. Specialty chemicals, we're focused on high-value products and markets. It's more and more specializing and creating value in the markets that we serve and selectively building on our technology and market presence. And then if I could sort of bring it down just to kind of a nearer term focus, these are some of the goals that we have for this year around the initiatives and growth and innovation. We're working to strengthen our voice to the customer tools. We have a goal to improve the vitality of our sales, which means the proportion of products coming from, or proportion of our sales coming from products and services introduced over the last 5 years. Commercial operations excellence, we are going to leverage this technique that we just talked about. We want to introduce a broader tool set and then, of course, continue to drive annual continuous cost savings out of our operations excellence initiative. Leadership and organization development, we're doing some organization structure and focus work. We have a talent development process that we're taking across the organization and common leadership training for all of our managers and employees. And then you can see we're focusing on returns and working capital intensity, as well as a sharpened focus on the numbers in our financial excellence initiative. So if I could just sum up with a few points that you could take away from this presentation. We're developing the organizational leadership capabilities in our businesses. We've implemented growth and excellence initiatives that we think are going to further drive our success. We have a clear strategic roadmap to create value, and we have near-term objectives in 2014 that we think support the business opportunities that we have. The team that you're going to see next is committed to doing this and making these businesses better so that they can achieve their full potential. So with that, I'd take any questions.
All right, thanks for taking my question, Ivan Marcuse. If you looked at your slide with your return on net assets and your return on net assets, for Magna Materials, you paid a lot of money for it a couple of years ago. The returns in the mid to low single digits have to be, I guess, today a little bit disappointing. So even with EBITDA margin going up last year, your return on net assets on your math fell 100 basis points. So how do you get that to turn around? Do you need to take more costs out of the business? I understand you want to do innovation, but 4-5% return on net assets off of that investment, how do you get that moving in the right direction? What ultimately is your goal?
So, okay, you know, in the 2012 number, we've got a little bit of that rare earth effects, you know, overflow, but the statement that you made is absolutely right. The 4% return on net assets is not where we want to be in this business, and it's a important target for us to improve. So I think really the two paths that we're going down is we have, again, the reason we bought the magnetic technologies business is there are some truly exciting growth opportunities in this business, and through the innovation process we're going to be able to continue to grow at a higher profitability and higher return in this business. The second part of that is continuing to work on and chip away at the cost structure in this business, improving our competitiveness. And, you know, I think there's several paths. One is the path that we talked about and going down looking at where do we make money, where don't we make money, how do we better deploy the resources in that business. Another one that this business has been working on for a while is making sure we're producing products in the place that's most effective for us. We have, over time, been moving our cores and components production into lower-cost regions. And, in fact, I think 2014 will be the first year that all of our cores and components production is going to come from lower-cost regions. These are longer-term strategies that we have to pursue. We've got quite a center of excellence and critical mass in our headquarters there in Germany, but this is what we're thinking about. How do we address these in the long term? So we're going to chip away through commercial excellence. We're going to chip away through the continuous improvement process and think strategically about how do we address that cost structure over the long term.
Well, I guess where do you think you could get return on that asset or EBITDA margin over the three to five-year period? So that doesn't, I'm not asking for next year, but if you look at 3 to 5 years, you've been able to dig under the hole, look under the hood now for about a year. So how do you get that up, and what's your target?
I don't know if I want to sort of pick a single target in a single year that we're going to get there, but what I can tell you is it is a primary focus within this business. We talk a lot about growth and return on investment and the balance that we need to draw between those. And within the magnetic materials business, we've got a great degree of focus on driving up that return on investment. What I can say is we will and are focused on driving that return on investment up every year, and we have a goal of getting these businesses earning their cost of capital, as Chris has suggested.
I feel it's more important that we continue to drive returns up every year than get to a particular threshold and stop there. We think that this business has good growth opportunities in front of it, as you'll hear. That growth helps us to drive margins. Some of the cost reduction programs that David talked about will help to drive that as well. But we're not looking for a step function change in a single year to happen. We think this will be a continuous improvement, and you'll see those margins as we look at it year over year continue to drive up. And that's what creates value, is the expansion of the business and the growth in the returns.
Yeah, Ivan, the other way I would answer it is just exactly what David was talking about with this commercial excellence and, delving into these product lines. I think that's a lot of the headroom we have to be able to do that, and we're just educating, auguring in on our people, basically taking a company that we acquired out of private equity and to think in these terms that we're holding them accountable for.
Hi. Oh, I'm sorry.
Please.
As long as she's here. Just a quick question on the vitality. What proportion of your sales currently come from products done in the last 5 years? Where did it come from? Where do you hope it to be?
So, again, this is something that we're looking at as, let's call it again, a continuous improvement initiative. Today, I'd say we're in the low teens on vitality, but it's something that, we're trying to focus on making it better every year.
This slide you presented on kind of product line profitability is instructive. I'm curious, is this an actual example from one of your divisions?
Yeah, I would say it's a somewhat stylized from an actual situation that we have in our businesses, and it is not atypical to see in industrial, even especially the chemicals businesses. So one of the reasons we put that in there is that is sort of a, somewhat broader result you can see from businesses when you take this focus and approach.
And I think my question is, you identify actions as let's focus on the cost, let's try to get the price up, and try to grow the areas where we make the most money and the highest margins. That all makes sense. But at what point do you come to a decision and just say, hey, if we're losing, getting our heads handed to us in this product line, maybe we just should exit that product line?
Absolutely. I think that Joe and Greg have talked about the kind of portfolio exercise at the top of the organization. It's really no different when you go deep down inside the organization. You ask yourself, if we're putting resources against something that isn't now providing a benefit, and we don't see in the fairly near-term future it providing a benefit, then we ask ourselves, why keep doing that? So I can tell you, we've taken some action, and we are actually moving away from business that where we don't think it's the best place for us to be or putting our business in it. And when we get to the specialty chemical side, you'll see a couple of examples of that.
So that was actually my question. So just following up on it, Are you also looking at customers? As you said, you want to, you know, raise, be paid for the value that you are offering. So are you able, do you have the IT system in place to allow you to actually know which product lines are profitable, which ones are not? Same thing regarding your customers. And are you willing to walk away from a customers? And if the product line shows that there is possibility for an improvement, how long do you give it? Is it a two-year time frame, or do you walk away within 6 months if you think that, you know, it is not happening?
Yeah, so I would answer the first question about our systems is we have the basic platforms that will allow us to do this. There are systemic tools. You know, you have the basic platforms. You do a lot of work to extract information out of those platforms, and typically you do this as a one-off project because there's a lot of work that goes into making sure you've got it right. You don't want to make wrong decisions with, you know, with bad information, and that's kind of the work that we've been doing. Now our effort is to make this systemic so that we can do it, use those basic platforms, modify them so that we can get this information on an ongoing basis and get it into more people's hands, you know, who can drive these decisions as more of a natural part of the process. Are we able to do this? When you do it by product, you can ultimately do it by customer. And are we willing to walk away from a customer where we don't see a path toward earning reasonable profitability and good return? Absolutely. It's easy to look at this information and say, gosh, here's an easy strategy, just walk away from these customers. We want to be careful about that. The first thing we want to look at is, you know, is there something about this that we just haven't maximized the value out of what we've done in this situation? So it's a case-by-case, very detailed process of going through and optimizing what we're doing. But we're not at all afraid, and in fact, we have already walked away from some customers where we didn't see the opportunity to get it where we thought we needed it to be.
I think we have time for one more question.
Yeah, one more
question. Hi, Rand Gessing with Duberger Berman. I'd like to just go back to Ivan's question because I think it's critical, the magnetic tech return is your largest business, and
mm-hmm.
where that yellow dot goes is going to really be a key in where your valuation is down the road. I see this, the working capital slide you showed, it's much higher working capital percentage to revenues. I mean, maybe we could turn the question around. Are there some structural issues around the business that preclude, you know, that RONA going to 10% or something like that? I mean, you've got a fair bit of auto, but not too much. Industrial usually is a good end market to get good returns. So just this is one metric, should we expect, are there any reasons why that wouldn't get to be better?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the metric that you're looking at? You mean working capital?
The slide that Chris showed, yeah.
Right.
I mean, is there a reason that that couldn't be more?
So, you know, I think that when you see a working capital as a percent of sales at that level, you end up looking inside and you see we've got a cycle time in that process that can be an extended cycle time. And I'd say there are some structural reasons in that. And if you're operating, for instance, in the permanent magnet space outside of China, you're going to have a more extended, no matter who you are, you're going to have more extended cycle time because the rare earths are coming out of China. That adds time, and it ultimately adds a little bit of working capital in the process. Those are issues and opportunities that don't get solved overnight. Those are things that we're strategically focused on. In fact, we've talked a lot about the cycle time in the magnetic materials business and what options we have at different parts of the value stream to optimize that. And in fact, the VOC business has already taken some steps, and we've made some progress along the way. But so as we look at returns, I think both the numerator, growing the business, working on our cost structure, and the denominator are both opportunities for us to try to improve the returns in that business.
Okay. Do you want to introduce Hartman?
So our next speaker is Dr. Hartmut Eisele. Dr. Eisele has been with VOC for 11 years. I think next week celebrates his 11th year anniversary. And he's going to have a chance to come up and tell you about some of the exciting opportunities we have at VOC.
Thank you, David. good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about magnetic technologies. Let me guide you into the specialties of the magnetic technology activities. This company is designing and manufacturing magnetic materials and products with significant differentiation with respect to the performance. We provide solutions over the entire magnetic field and value chain and provide these components, products, and base materials to a broad customer base. It is worthwhile to note that more than 85% of our sales are done with specific customized solutions. How do we do that? We employ more than 160 scientists and engineers and enjoy more than 750 patents that defend and protect our products. The best results are always achieved when we are working together with our customers in the early design phase, and this typically results in very close customer relationships that allow us to sell our products for more than 10, 15 years into the market. We continuously design and innovate, and we have a pipeline of more than 500 new products and new products with our customers, serving currently more than 5,000 products with more than 100 applications, and a continuous focus on improvements of our operations. This is an overview and a very compressed chart showing you some of the applications, products, and end markets that we serve out of our three business divisions, materials and parts, cores and components, and permanent magnets. And I know everybody of you is a customer of different airlines every day almost. Whenever this cargo plane is loaded, it is depending on components from WAC, typically displaying high reliability, high efficiency, and making sure that there is no delay because of the cargo is stuck in the cargo plane. Going to the cores and components activities, if you talk about photovoltaic inverter, the key point is that components used from WAC are providing a 3 to 5% better efficiency. Calculate on the lifetime of a solar panel field of roughly 20 years, you can imagine how much money is created out of this application when the efficiency is higher by 3 to 5%. Quickly talking about permanent magnets, we are famous for advanced magnet assemblies. Key point is that the power of these permanent magnets is so strong that you need expertise to glue, adjust it to sub-assemblies so the end customer can later on screw that, maybe on a wind generator setup. Here's a quick timeline. So the company was founded 90 years ago, but I think more important is the pipeline of innovation in the upper part, showing you only a very condensed summary of what our innovation pipeline is typically filled with. And let me quickly pick one example. In the year 2013, and we all talked about the rare earth price peak, there was a significant demand from our customer side to reduce the most expensive composition in these permanent magnets, that was Dy, or dysprosium. And we were up to that challenge and succeeded, so we are now offering Dy-free or almost Dy-free materials for the markets. That's very well prepared for future hiccups that nobody wants to see in the market with base material coming out of China. Financial overview, I think this was discussed quite intensively. So year after year, in magnetic technologies, you see the effect of the rare earth effect. That was unfavorable in the range of $113 million and $22 million U.S. dollar in EBITDA. With a few of the activities that David mentioned earlier, we increased our EBITDA margins, mainly driven by cost savings, and we will continue to do so. To give you a flavor, the split of the businesses is typically 30% for materials and parts division, 30% for cores and components, and 40% for the permanent magnet division. This shows our operation setup. On the left-hand side, this is our headquarters in Hanau, where we have a concentration of our engineering capabilities and our melt shop to create the base material that we need. And so we are able to protect our intellectual property and our know-how in Germany. There are three activities for permanent magnet. There is a location in Ulvila in Finland, activities in Ningbo in China, and our joint venture in Sanwag in Beijing. The two other factories in Shenyang and in Malaysia, in Kuantan, are dedicated to cores and components activities. Our factory in Honastrada in Slovakia is a mixed factory serving all three business units. With respect to operations excellence, our focus in 2014 is on further automation of manufacturing processes, especially for high-volume products. Naturally, we are realizing energy and production supply savings. And as you saw with the manufacturing setup, we are continuously optimizing our logistics and packing costs. And this company is well set up for delivering annual continuous improvement savings. And we involve down the people down to the shop floor as well. So this picture is showing you the integrated approach for soft magnetic materials as well as magnets. We start with the base material, with the raw material, and then we follow along the magnetic technology participation lane, as you can see, and we are selling on each step of the production. As I mentioned earlier, the basis for all material we use inside is Hanau. And Hanau is also the center for product and application research and development, as well as intellectual property creation and manufacturing expertise. Here it's a pretty busy chart, but the message behind is on the right-hand side, you see a set of key end markets. And this is clearly indicating that we are supplying out of all our three business units into these key end markets. With respect to our customers, you see all worldwide recognized leaders in their industries. The important thing for us and the new approach that we are pursuing is that you find more and more customers like Huawei, Lear, Flextronics, and alike, companies outside of our historical European customer base. This slide is talking about a new application. This is a specialty magnetocaloric alloy for refrigeration application. The reason why we are dealing with this kind of material, first of all, we have the technology to create this material composition. Second point, we see an opportunity to really change the world of refrigeration as it is known in the industry at the moment. I don't want to hide that this technology is still in an infant stage. We are prepared and ready to provide the base material that is needed for that application. We are linked, and this is an example of a French company, Cooltech, but we are also talking to GE, LG, Samsung, and the like. This is at least the base of the technology for a different refrigeration approach for the future with a lot of potential. Now, more back to earth, more back to what we do on a day-to-day basis. First message I would like you to give is that the design end cycle might be, in some cases, pretty long. So this is an example for a part for an electric power-assisted steering system called a torque sensor. So the design started and the R&D involvement started around 2000. In the meantime, as you can see on the timeline, we are already producing this component by the millions. And that's the best part of the whole presentation in this case, we already have the contract for building 20,000 pieces in the year 2017. And this is translating into a tonnage of 400 tons of material, all based on co-development. Another example, similar timelines, we are producing a stator and a rotor for the main generator of Boeing Airlines and also of the Airbus industry. The beauty of these products and product lines is that once you are designed in, you enjoy 10 to 15 years of lifetime with these products and growing penetration. If we go back to the torque sensor in the automotive industry or here in the airline industry, Greg, Joe, and David talked a lot about opportunities with material technologies. And what you could see there, at the moment, we look like a Europe-centric company. One counterexample, if you look into our service that we do for the automotive industry, and I'm sure everybody of you is aware how well BMW, Daimler, Volkswagen is doing in countries outside of Europe. So there is a lot of sales going to either USA or Asia, and our company is participating in that by our products that are built in into these automotive cars. Similar approaches yield as well for the industrial applications. Nevertheless, as you can see, there is room for improvement with respect to direct activities in the Americas and in Asia. So, a few highlights in the markets. And early on, we talked about some mega trends, and clearly you find our company involved in these mega trends. Here, for example, is the automotive industry. We expect a good growth above the market growth. Reason is pretty simple. There are regulations for NOx reductions or electrification of vehicles, or, and this is the area where we grow most, new electronic or electrical devices, and they grow with a vast, much faster pace than the overall car industry. Here's a set of examples. I will not read that out to you. Just one remark to the parts on that lower side, these parts for gasoline injection. We produce these parts in the hundreds of millions a year. We are, and I think that's an exception, single source to one of the major suppliers in the automotive industry. And to give you an order of magnitude, these components are driving 12.5 million new cars built every year. Same approach we have for parts for diesel injections. We are supplying first, second, and third generation. And again, this is supporting the intensity where we do our R&D and development work together with our customers, because this is giving us an early indication what is needed on the market and where we could generate volume business for our activities. And typically, when you talk about magnetic technologies, we talk about optimized energy usage, weight and space reduction, as well as extreme temperature stability. And the growth opportunities are on the lower side. I think you get a flavor of that already. Now, industrial is another base of our business. And there you typically need an increasing speed for the automation equipment and an increase of efficiency of energy consumption. Some applications there, and I think you see that, for example, the watt-hour meter on the lower part is generated and based for the U.S. market, replacing the old-fashioned metering system where you had to have somebody coming around your house and go there and do the readout. The modern electronic watt-hour meters, where we are supplying components to, can be read out from a road or from the block, around the block, and would allow for future to optimize the energy consumption according to external influence that you generate on a base, how expensive your energy per time unit is. For these applications, you need high accuracy, linearity, and also temperature stability. And that all leads into higher efficiency for industrial motors or electronic watt-hour meters, frequency converters for drives, and other industrial applications. Now, renewables, a very hot subject. You all know what happened to the solar industry in Europe in the years 2009-2010. In 2010, we had an order book twice as big as we could supply from our current staff and manufacturing equipment. This market slowed down, is still existing in Europe, but the future growth will be outside of Europe. And there are governmental funding programs in China, Japan, and US, and we see that as Asia will become a leading market for this technology. Wind energy, there was a dip in growth because of the extreme high raw material cost. The raw material going down, or the raw material cost going down, is now supporting to supply and to move that technology forward, because there are a lot of technology improvement possibilities with permanent magnet-driven wind generators. Now it takes a second. This is an application for renewables. I think you heard about the solar impulse flying across the U.S., powered by solar energy. And guess who provided the motors? The magnets and the soft magnetic alloys that were into these motors to provide highest efficiency and lowest energy consumption, they all came from WAC. So typical applications for our industry here is solar inverters and wind energy generators, and you see the key drivers and the key players on this market in the lower end of the chart. Talking about permanent magnets, what we can provide to our customers is assembly experience with extremely large and powerful magnets. On top of that, we are able to design high-efficiency power chokes and current sensors with high accuracy and temperature stabilities. Both components are vital for maximum optimization of the usage of green energy, wind energy, solar energy. Some other markets. Aerospace, I talked about the more electric aircraft, our supplies to Boeing and Airbus. And there is another interesting project around the road. You know, typically the airplanes are starting their main engines and then they are driving towards the runway. The approach in this case is to provide electromotors at the tires and move the airplane in a much more environmental friendly and energy reduction approach to the runway. Electronic article surveillance. I'm sure everybody in this room has experience with these kind of techs. We are supplier to Tyco Sensematic. To give you a feel, even if those techs look pretty tiny and lightweight, we provide roughly 850 tons of material that goes into these applications. And the interesting part is it's a one-way product. Safety devices will grow in countries in Europe according to the development of the construction business, but the interesting, exciting market is Asian, real estate, China, and India, and we already have new additional customers for these applications. To summarize the takeaways, I hope you understand that we serve attractive and growing end markets. We are very well positioned to commercialize new products and applications. We have a lot of growth opportunities in NAFTA and Asia, and we drive efficiency in our operations through continuous improvement and operation excellence initiatives as laid out by David. On top of that, we benefit from the mega trends. So at the end of the day, at the moment, we are serving more than 1,700 customers with 5,000 existing products for more than 100 applications. And our funnel of new projects with customers is very well filled with more than 500 projects. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks. Kevin Hostovar, North Coast Research. You mentioned wanting to go geographically more outside of Europe. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on what initiatives you have, what are the main drivers that you're enacting on to grow outside of Europe, and also what would be the ideal mix of sales by geography?
So to answer the first question, did everybody understand the question is how we grow outside of Europe? So especially for China, we started some years ago already, instead of having just a sales force locally, to increase the number of application engineers in that country. And localization in this case means that we have to have experts that understand our technology in the same time zone and with the same language skills that you need to work in those markets. Our customers in Korea, they don't like to have data sheet in English. They want to see the data sheet in the local language. And they want, if there is a question or if there is topics to be discussed, they want to do that in the same time zone. So this is how we do that in Asia. And as Greg mentioned earlier, if there is a bolt-on acquisition opportunity that would be on top of the normal organic approaches would be the way to go.
Thank you for the presentation. You offered a good understanding of the business. It seems like you're selling a lot of, like as you said, components and parts, but not a lot of solutions. And I guess the way I think about it is moving up a value chain is being able to package some of them together for a solution. Do you have plans to do that? I didn't see that in this presentation. Or do you need to acquire certain
capabilities to be able to get there?
As I mentioned earlier, we are developing a lot of activities together with our customers. So at the end of the day, the sub-assembly is the solution. But the customer can never do this solution without our material knowledge, our knowledge in the magnetic field area. And I am a little bit mixed because I would still call that a solution, but the basic strategy is to be able to sell our components or our materials into more than one customer. And this worked quite well for the last 20 years. So that was the reason we didn't go into the motor business or generator business or like, but that allows us to really sell to competing companies in the same or similar applications for the end product. And that allowed us to widen our markets and to create the volumes that we need to fill our factory.
Thank you. Fascinating business, but just to help me understand it, you showed two slides on slides 51 and 52, which are the torque sensor and the stator rotor. What's your price for those? Are those price? Is it pennies or is it? How do you? I mean, just order of magnitude. I don't want to know your exact price, but I want to understand what it means.
So for the torque sensor, let's put it the single digit euro range. Digit euro. Single digit euro. If you go for the stator, that is in the minimum three-digit euro arena, to give you an order of magnitude.
Hi, Chris Capsch with Topeka Capital Markets again. And so my question gets at the margin profile of your business. If you talk about the business being, you know, based on differentiation, customized solutions, once you get spec'd in, it's difficult to get displaced. So that all does speak to specialization, yet there's this paradox of a margin profile that doesn't seem all that specialized. And so there's some initiatives, it sounds like, you know, top-line growth will contribute nice incrementally to margins. You're focused on the cost structure, but it seems like maybe a large opportunity for your business and for the company and for its shareholders has to do with this initiative of commercial excellence. I was just wondering if you could talk about how you see that playing into your business. Is the organization embracing it, and is there any way to dimensionalize what the opportunity is in embracing commercial excellence over time?
So we are working on all of those initiatives in parallel. One of the points that is inherent into our business is that we are operating a melt shop. The melt shop is necessary to provide the quality of the base material because the magnetic properties are extremely sensitive to impurities. So this needs to be done in-house. And the melting operation is a volume operation to absorb the necessary fixed costs. And that means the rule of the game for this kind of the operation is to maximize volume. And this is where we are heading towards, and I think those components that I showed you as an example, translated into melt volume, is the right way to go. In parallel, we are increasing prices, we are selecting customers. To give you a feeling, in the year 2004, we closed two factories. We laid off hundreds of people because we stepped out with our permanent magnet division out of the hard disk drive business. The hard disk drive business required a set of magnets for the read-write head to elevate that sensitive component above the magnetic disk. And we were a player in the order of magnitude of 3% turnover compared to the rest of the competition. And our customers expected us to do a cost down or price down 3 to 5% every quarter. So in 2004, we decided this is not the business to be in. And we do this kind of decisions on a continuous basis. And we have no problem to lose certain customers.
Going through the same kind of process that the rest of the business has. In fact, has just finished up some work. But with what Hartmut just described, you get into something that's sort of an extra step that you have to look at, because instead of looking at a specific product or a specific customer, you have to look at its impact on the internal value chain in the business, and that's what adds an additional step in the process. But they're walking down through the process and finding opportunities, and I think just the same as all our businesses.
And there is another approach as well on a technology roadmap. Mm-hmm. So some of those products are still done, and we call that the crystalline part. So you do melting, you do hot rolling, you do cold rolling, you do stamping. And we have a second business line that is continuous growing, and this is what we call rapid solidification. That means all these steps that I just described are done in one deposition step. And you can imagine this is the way to go. And a lot of the components and its particles that we show outside are based on this new technology already. On the other hand, we still have existing customers, and I can't let down automotive industry that is building 12.5 million cars with our components and just tell them, sorry guys, we stop now. So this is the dilemma, but the positive dilemma, because we make money on that as well. That's the actual dilemma we are always linked in. Positive thing is when you are aligned with your customer, it is hard to replace you. On the other hand, you have an obligation to supply to his technology as long as his technology is out in the field.
Thanks for the presentation. Do you have any examples of success of getting, like, let's take automotive, for example, the success of expanding into those geographic markets? I think back in 2011 when VAC was acquired, that was one of the points that was brought up, where right now it looks like you're leveraged towards the German automakers but really don't have much exposure at all to Japanese, Koreans, or Detroit. So what prevents you from getting in there? Who's supplying there? And have you any why aren't they using your product?
So we have customers that serve the U.S. automotive industry, and we have customers in Korea, but not at the moment to the extent I would like to have. Key point is, on the one hand side, the beauty of the business, on the other hand side, the drawback. We are selling highly specialized materials, and this needs to be tailored together with the customer to his needs and his demand. We are not competing with standard products. And that means you have to have somebody on site, and during our private equity time, the focus was a little bit different from what we now can do with the group in OMG, where we are a member since a few years. Yeah. For example, we still have a location in E-Town where we closed the permanent magnet activities, but this is the center of our sales organization in U.S., and there are a vast variety of those additional projects with the customers are coming from U.S., from Asia, and from Korea. And you will see the results in the coming years, filling up the pipeline and increasing profitability.
I mean, maybe one specific application, the torque sensor that you showed in this, will ultimately the technology may be adapted to specific customer applications will ultimately lead to Asian automotive
right.
companies. And
yeah. Unfortunately, this is covered by NDA, but that single example that I showed to you is just the beginning, because those kind of sensors will be widely used in the automotive industry worldwide. And we have unique selling potential in this field.
Going back to those examples on page 51 and 52, could you share with us the revenues you are getting from them in 2011, and then you show this big jump in demand or supply in 2017. So what would be the potential there, and can you compare the margin of those product lines in 2011 and then in 2017?
And for the benefit of our customer relationships and all that, we probably don't want to delve too much into margins and total revenues. But what we hope is by showing you the volumes that we've got on the chart, and I think to an earlier question, we talked about the unit values. We hope that gives you an opportunity to size the growth that we've enjoyed in that market, as well as the potential we see as those volumes grow in 2017.
Well, you also talked about commodities and walking out of some product lines. So as you get to those high volumes, do they become more commodities because now you are getting out millions of them or millions of tons or however you calculate it? And so how long of a life cycle do those new products have? Do you have 2 years, 3 years, or do they become commodities sooner than that?
So first answer is they will never become a commodity because it is specialized material and specialized production process to keep the magnetic capabilities or magnetic properties. That's typically something you don't see, you can't feel, and you just see a piece of metal. But the important thing is we are not really selling metal, we are selling magnetic properties to our customers. The alloy composition and the way to produce those components is in-house know-how. And our competitors have a tough time to copy that. They may do a reverse engineering on the alloy composition, but that does not make them able to do the production process so that the same result is generated. That's the first answer to that question. The second one is the beauty of being in the automotive industry. Once you are designed in one of those platforms are typically running 10 to 15 years. So down the road, 10 to 15 years, with just one single customer, we gave you a flavor how the volumes will develop, but there are more customers around that we can serve with similar products, and it's a penetration of this technology into the automotive industry that was not existing some years ago.
Thank you. That is very helpful. If I can just ask a quick translation, DY-free, does that mean with no rare earth?
No, without the most expensive component of rare earth. It's dysprosium. So typically the magnet, the main composition is neodymium, iron, boron. If you want to have a very temperature stable magnet, you need to add a sort of dopant of these dysprosium material on top. And now we are able to do the same properties with either very much reduced Dy or even without Dy.
We'll just take one more quick question.
One more along that line. You said that while you were in private equity hands, you couldn't have offices in Japan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So are these same products being made by a competitor and supplied to the Japanese and the Americans and others, or are they doing it in a different way?
In most cases, they do it in a different way. And typically, as you know, how the Japanese industry is working, they typically try to buy in-house. But we have examples where they have to come to us because of our technology, because of our offering. So we are also selling into Japan.
Okay, so before we wrap up, the one, you know, Ivan and you know, all of you kind of, Chris was asking, you were asking the same questions. You know, we've got this specialized business, we've got high technology. You know, do these margins reflect that? You know, and I just want the entire group to know that, you know, this leadership team and Hartmut, you know, we're very cognizant of the upside potential we have by these excellence initiatives. I think when you combine what David talked about with commercial excellence, product line analysis, you know, education of moving away from cost-plus pricing models, you know, we are absolutely geared into that, and we recognize the potential headroom we have to grow the overall returns of this business. So if there's any takeaway that I would like the group to know, we are absolutely ratcheted into that, and so is the leadership team at VOC.
So what would the incremental margin be as a step-up production?
Right. Incremental margins generally for us are about 30% across the enterprise. And so the incremental margins, actually, as you get, if you look at the type of analysis that we're doing now where we're dropping all the way down to product line profitability, what you're seeing is that we have products with contribution margins today that are less than zero. Those are ones that are having one course of action. We've actually got others that are over 70%. And so we don't really want to, you know, pick and choose in this form here, but we've got so many, you know, different products. But as we look across the enterprise, generally, we're in that sort of 30% range. Parts of it are, yeah. Some are more labor-intensive, and a lot of that business of this magnetic business in particular, we've moved a lot of that to lower-cost locations where we leverage the better labor costs. We've got other elements that are more fixed-cost-oriented, more technology-driven. Some of that remains in higher-cost or German locations. But I also want to answer the question about margins in a different way. We've talked publicly about this business having a range of 12 to sort of 17% EBITDA margins over the course of its operation throughout a cycle. And one of our objectives is to take that and shift that entire range up. And whether we get to 300 or 500 bips, that's the, you know, the direction that we're heading, is to shift that whole margin range up. It's no surprise that outside of automotive and a couple other good markets, we've been operating in lower demand levels for some of the industrial applications in Europe. And so today we operate in a lower margin regime with a lower demand regime as well. So we see a lot of opportunity as that market continues to strengthen. And then I guess lastly what I'd say is if you just do that math, where we talk about 5% growth and 30% incremental margins, I think that provides, that alone provides a path of how you can in a year gain, you know, 1 to 2 points of margin and returns in a business. So a couple of different ways to think about it from a more quantitative standpoint.
How long do we have, Mary Lou?
I think we're...
Take
a 10-minute break and start back up with battery technology.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome back. Good morning. My name is Randy Moore, and I'm the leader of OM Group's Battery Technology segment. The Battery Technology segment focuses its energy on high reliability applications, high reliability programs. As you can see from the picture, down at the bottom, the pictures across the bottom of the page, the high reliability market is one where critical applications where failure is measured in hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment failure, or in some cases actually in human life. So therefore, failure is just not an option. These are markets that are very attractive because, like with magnetic technologies, our products get designed in, and they usually stay in the product for the life cycle of the product itself. In some cases, these products are measured in many decades. We have expertise in over 30 chemistries, and we serve some truly exceptional customers with engineered solution. I'm excited about our future because of the technical innovation that we embarked on 5 to 10 years ago is coming to fruition now in some of the emerging markets that we're focused on. We have a very rich heritage that goes back. We've been in continuous operation for 170 years, but really it's been the last 100 or so years where we've actually been working on battery technologies going back into the early 20s.
Since about 1944, we have been the go-to battery manufacturer for the U.S. government. And more recently, which is always more interesting, is what have you done lately? We've been involved heavily in the space program. Our batteries are credited for having brought Apollo 13 home. If you've seen the movie with Tom Hanks, you remember that scene where they were calculating the life cycle of the battery and how many hours it would run and keep the astronauts alive. The guy who was actually doing that still works for us. He's had 53 years with the company now, and he's still an active employee of Eagle Picture. So, and that space program has continued. More recently even than that, we helped lower the Curiosity to the surface of Mars. Our batteries were involved in that. Our batteries in space, we've got close to 1 million implantable batteries now that are walking around inside people. We've got, and the next month, we're going to pass 2 billion cell hours. We passed 1.9 billion cell hours in space in 2013. We'll pass 2 billion in the next couple months. So we're real proud of our heritage. And we're proud of our financial performance. We're growing, and we're going strong. We've got a really strong backlog in defense and in medical, and really strong growth in medical, spurred mostly by the adoption of new medical devices that provide emerging technology in electrochemical therapy replacing pharmaceutical therapy. Lots of opportunities in our growth markets, and these are offsetting. Now, you've heard, I mean, you've seen in the news that there are challenges to the defense budget. So a company that has historically been a majority of our sales into the government markets, you would wonder how we feel about our future. We feel very strong because our future is we've been investing in these emerging markets that are mostly commercial in their nature. I'm not telling you that our defense market's going down. In fact, I've got charts that I'll get to later that says that our defense market is really stable because of the type of products that we're built into. This chart really boils down to one thing, and that's in the title of it. It's a culture. We want our workers to be able to say, what if we did this? And they're listened to by management, and that turns into change, continuous improvement, that's actually from the bottoms up. And that's the gist of the whole chart, is that we've got everybody engaged in actual continuous improvement activities, and we're seeing it in our results. We call this our market wheel, and going around it clockwise, you can see that still the biggest part of our business is defense, but that's moving toward a much more balanced approach. We're in 85% of all the missiles in the U.S., I'm going to go into more of the detail on this on subsequent charts, so I'm going to go around this very quickly. We do portable power for soldiers. In aerospace, this includes satellites, space exploration, aircraft. And you see aircraft in here twice, and that may seem a bit confusing. But what we've done is we have isolated the aerospace market for main start batteries around lithium ion as an emerging market. But we've been in aircraft batteries for decades, going back to the 70s. And so our legacy aircraft business is really depicted in this part of the chart and our emerging market up at the top. In medical, we're in cardiac and rhythm management, but our real growth opportunity here is in neuromodulation. We were the first lithium-ion battery ever implanted, and that's the biggest part of our growth opportunity in the future. The emerging markets, I'll talk more about alternative energy, alternative and grid energy storage, and I'll also talk more about commercial aerospace later and oil and gas, what we're doing in the oil and gas area. We really like to be to the left on this chart and up, high ASPs and lower quantity, and that typifies the high reliability market that I was talking about. An example of this that I'll talk about more when we get into defense is this. I showed some of you when we were walking around. This is a sulfur dioxide battery, and this battery has been around in the military for several decades, and it has become a commodity. And if you look at this chart, you see this battery in particular is represented by that dot. We have exited this business because it moved. It's very high quantity, and you can see where it is on the ASP side of the chart. What we instead went to is we went to a lithium carbon monofluoride battery.
this battery lasts about 8 hours. The soldier carries 10 to 20 pounds of these into battle. This battery lasts 16 hours, so the soldier can carry half as much into battle. The ASP on this is triple what it was on the ones we've exited. And that really typifies everything in the gray zone. We focus on where we can add technical value and have a value proposition that's superior and commands a higher margin, higher price. Just a little primer on batteries. I was talking before we started about what primary batteries and what secondary batteries are. Primary batteries, just simply, most of you know this, but primary batteries you can't recharge. We love those kind of batteries. They're the kind of batteries you buy at Walmart and put in your flashlight. You throw them away when you're done with them. We like that because if you throw it away when you're done with it, we get to sell you another one. And the reason we concentrate on primary batteries is we do a lot of work for the military, and the military shoots a missile, and they tend not to go get it and use it again. They just work it that way. Rechargeable batteries are anything that you can actually reverse the field on and you can and bring it back up in its life. And the most common example that we all deal with in our daily lives is our cell phones. Our cell phones have lithium-ion batteries. Our cars have main start batteries that are made out of lead acid, and those are rechargeable batteries. And then where we really add the value is in the area of the battery management system. The battery management system balances the battery, controls its depth of discharge, it handles the safety features of the battery, and it's really what integrates the energy solution into the customer system. And so we do consider ourselves to be a subsystem solution provider. In fact, we're considering changing the name of that tech segment to energy solution segment. I'm not officially doing that. Just saying. So in our, I mentioned we're doing, this isn't quite 30 chemistries, but the idea of this chart is to tell you that we look at our customers as opportunities. We don't look at our chemistries as sales tools. Our customers come to us and they say, we have this problem. And the problem may be in space, it may be underwater, it may be out on the battlefield, it may be in a car. We have actually helped automotive customers work with their battery management systems. And we look at their problem, we look at their load profile, and we look at how they're going to use the battery, and we optimize the energy storage system for them around what chemistry is the right chemistry. And I've got a very specific example coming up in just a minute. But we have 150 engineers in our engineering department, 100 engineers in our quality department. We have a very large R&D staff, and all of these individuals are out talking to our existing customers and new customers about what their energy storage problems are. So the expertise in numerous chemistries is somewhat unique to Eagle Picture. Most companies focus on one, two, or three chemistries, most of them one or two. Our product life cycle is a very robust product life cycle, and we're constantly looking for things that are going out of cycle and looking for ways to replace that with new chemistries and new technologies that are coming in cycle. An example of this is our nickel hydroxide. I've already talked about sulfur dioxide and how we're replacing that with sodium or with lithium carbon monofluoride. But another big example is this is our satellite battery, and this is nickel hydrogen. And the market is moving toward accepting this as a lithium-ion battery to replace space applications in satellites. And across the board, you can see there are many examples where we're actually sensing our obsolescence coming, sensing the obsolescence of a chemistry or a product line coming at us, and we've got a pipeline of 60 to 100 R&D projects at any given time that we're replenishing our product life cycle. Just to give you some ideas of the addressable markets that we're talking about, the emerging markets, of course, are emerging. They've got pretty high CAGRs. Alternative energy, I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. New market opportunities in downhole and subsea drilling, expansion of the drilling needs, and the way that we're drilling now is different, so the energy requirements for drilling is higher. In medical, you see a composite there of 10% growth in medical devices. Actually, that's a composite of 6 to 8 on the cardio side and 12 to 15 on the neuro side. And NeuroMod uses lithium ion, which is really where we do some primary batteries that are used for cardio, but most of our growth is in lithium ion, and we're really growing like gangbusters there. The number of new medical devices being introduced every day using batteries is staggers up. Space and satellite, now you see a couple numbers there that are less than 5 and less than 5. And space and satellite, that's one where we see this move from nickel hydrogen to lithium ion. Now, the number of satellites being launched worldwide, I'm not telling you is decreasing. But what happens is if you take that nickel hydrogen battery versus the lithium ion battery, you're taking a battery that's about five times more expensive and replacing it with one that's five times less expensive. And so the overall top line opportunity there is coming down. There's also more competition in the lithium ion business, and that's why I'll talk about the lithium ion center of excellence in a few minutes. Now, you hear again about this downward pressure on the defense budget. We are not seeing that so much in our business. We are seeing a slight reduction in some of our orders year over year in some systems, but we are not seeing a reduction in our defense business overall. That's because we focus on areas like the special forces and munitions, which is what we go into, aren't being cut as much as personnel costs and large-scale systems. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about these. In terms of our defense market, our products I've already mentioned. You recognize the customers up there, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon are our top three customers, and they've been our top three customers year over year, followed closely by other defense contractors such as Textron, and we do sell directly to the Department of Defense as well. Our growth here is being fueled by the increase of what's called the electrification of the infantry, and it's the value proposition of being able to carry half the weight into battle and still accomplish the mission. Interesting, the special forces where we have been selling most of these, they don't want to carry half the weight. They want the same weight. They just want to be able to fight twice as long. In aerospace, we're on 600-some satellites, 458 of them are currently in orbit. I mentioned lowering the Mars Curiosity. In aircraft, this is a very, very attractive market to us as we see safe lithium ions being a very big part of this in the future. We do some aerospace work for special operations, and the customers there, our big customers, are Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, and, of course, in the space area, it's companies like Orbital and again, Lockheed Martin. Bit of a different format to this chart because of the applications that we go into. They're so varied, and I'm not going to read them off, but you can see that almost all parts of the body now that there is an electrochemical therapy available that was once treated with pharmaceuticals. You see the largest three customers up there, which everybody recognizes, St. Jude, Medtronic, and Boston Scientific. The interesting thing about them, I think, is that Medtronic and Boston Scientific both have their own factories. In fact, Medtronic is the largest manufacturer of medical batteries in the world, and yet they're still buying batteries from us. Boston Sci has a very nice battery plant in Minnesota. They're still buying from us. We have some unique technical advantages that bring these customers back to us for some of our solutions. In this area, I do want to mention that our distinct advantage here is in the ability to miniaturize a battery and get the most energy in the smallest potential platform. And this actually enables some of the devices to actually exist. Talk to you a little bit about our alternative and grid energy storage initiative, and you've heard some of this. You've heard some of this here in New York City, and I'll try to bring some of it home to what we're doing here in New York City. We have a couple proprietary technologies here. We have our power pyramid, and we also are working on a sodium. You see sodium beta on the chart. It's actually sodium nickel chloride, and what we're doing is that this has been a tubular product. And we are working on manufacturing technology here more than the chemistry itself to take this chemistry from a tubular product into a prismatic product. The prismatic product will run at about 50 degrees C cooler than its tubular counterpart, improving safety, increasing the life cycle, and reducing maintenance costs. But importantly to us as a manufacturer of battery cells, we'll be able to more highly automate a prismatic manufacturing line, and we'll be able to really well here on the cost. This has not been commercialized yet. We're still in the manufacturing feasibility phase of this. We have commercialized the power pyramid. We built a 2-megawatt-hour, 1-megawatt rate demonstrator. Back in 2011, we started it and commissioned it in 2012, and now we've had a number of sales in 2013 around this technology. And essentially, the technology is a hybrid approach. I mentioned earlier that we don't look at the problem and try to force-fit a chemistry to fit the problem. What we do is we look at the problem and say, what is the best chemistry for that problem? Well, it turns out in the case of grid energy storage that the problem doesn't fit nicely into any one bucket. So we decided we would use multiple chemistry in a hybrid approach to solve that problem. And the way that looks is you might have, and this is a sample of a 10, 30, 60 power pyramid, and this is not the same as Joe's pyramid, but it's maybe at the top of that pyramid where you've got a unique solution and your engineering value. The first chemistry, let's say that this chart was built around wind speed from an actual 250 megawatt nameplate wind farm in Kansas. And so what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to imagine this to be the demand profile of a building in New York City instead. And I'll talk through it. So imagine that you have a heat wave come through town, and all of a sudden half the air conditioners in your building kick on. Well, if you're the owner of this building, and the building is what they call a Cat B or a Type B building, where it doesn't have meters by every apartment, in fact, the landlord just factors his rent into the building cost, then the landlord's paying the electricity. Well, what if you see a spike coming, and you can take out just a few seconds of that spike and load level it? Well, you can control your peak charges. You can control your demand charges. And we would use a chemistry like lithium ion for that because some of these spikes can be quite onerous and they can actually drive the rates significantly. We might use a sodium sulfur layer to take out mid-range excursions where power and demand are not balanced. And then we might use a lead acid layer to take out a diurnal balancing. Another way to look at this is, what if another Hurricane Sandy comes through New York? How are you going to lower all the elevators? Well, either generators or the sales we've had in New York are contemplating the use of batteries to operate the elevators for several hours to get the people safely to the ground. So that's in oil and gas. We are working on we're doing things in subsea. We're doing things in what's called Christmas tree wellhead power at the ocean floor. We're working on downhole drilling. Just going to downhole drilling a little bit, we've got a hybrid chemistry that's able to withstand higher temperature. Current downhole solutions run up to about 150 degrees C. Our customers, potential customers, are telling us that they need 160 to 180, maybe even 200 degrees C centigrade, because they're going deeper. They're drilling in ways they haven't drilled before, slant drilling. They have sensors. They have sensors and measurement systems down near the drill head, and they need to be able to communicate with that. And so that their power requirements are outstripping the technology that's out there currently. So they're looking for a solution, and we're developing hybrid chemistries that will. It's a different kind of hybrid. The AGES system, our power pyramid, is a hybrid where we use electronics and control algorithms to shift between one chemistry and another. This hybrid, when we talk about hybrid, we're talking about like making a cake, and it depends on what kind of ingredients you put in the cake, how much energy, and what kind of temperatures you can control. Our 2014 initiatives, I'm going to handle this kind of go clockwise around the chart here and start with our batteries or our medical market. We're really excited about medical. I mentioned that before. We have the device you see in black there is actually a leadless pacemaker that is put inside the heart. And about half of what you see in that picture is battery, and about half of it is the pacemaker itself. And if you see the pens that are on your desk, the cap, the the part that you push down on the pen, if you I guess if you have one of the Eagle Pitcher pens from outside, it's the cap, is about the size of the battery. And so the device, the pacemaker itself, is about the same size as that battery. And what they do is they, instead of having to crack your chest open and put a pacemaker inside your chest, they can put it in via a stent, and they don't have to do open heart. But it goes actually inside your heart. So we want to those kind of innovations are why medical is exciting to us, because we have actually, since we've been at this for 12 years now, over the last, and devices can take as long as 7 years to move from trials to manufacturing production. We've been at this long enough now that several of our devices are making that transition from being in the trial phase, where we may sell a few hundreds of batteries, to the manufacturing phase, where we'll sell thousands of batteries. And so 2014 is the year when we're going to convert a couple of those batteries from trials to manufacturing, and that's very exciting to us. And we're going to continue to develop and increase our marketing share for these other alternative grid energy. I mentioned commercial aircraft before because we've been doing it since the 70s. But commercial aircraft here means safe lithium ion. Notwithstanding what's happened, some of the news around lithium ion batteries on aircraft, there are ways to make those batteries safe, and the advantages you get, and our focus has been on helicopter and light business aircraft. In helicopters and light business aircraft, the value proposition goes up dramatically. And then I've already mentioned what we're doing in oil and gas. Six Sigma, importance of Six Sigma and making that cultural is all goes back to our commercial and operational excellence initiatives. And we've got a big focus here. We've got metrics around it. We're measuring it, but it's more than that. It's cultural. It's getting our people aware that they can raise their hand and make a difference. This is also important. I want to stomp my foot about it a little bit, because as we transition a line from 400 batteries a month to 4,000 batteries a month, we have to design that line for continuous improvement if we're going to get the most margins out of that production process. And then finally, this is I guess my key initiative this year, lithium ion. You know how overbuilt lithium ion is in the United States in terms of capacity. So why is Randy Moore standing up here in front of you today and tell you that he's going to build more capacity in lithium ion? And the reason is because I want to capture that very, very small part where the customer say it just can't fail, and I need the most power that I can get out of a very small space or very lightweight. And that's what our center of excellence is all about. It's not about competing with the gigawatt factories out there that are cranking out lithium ion. It's competing with the it's competing for those customers who care more about power, weight, and quality than they care about price. And so this factory is going to be purpose-built around 250 watt-hour per kilogram. It's the same technology that we have approved by the federal government. We're one of only two suppliers out there approved by the federal government for the federal government brand of lithium ion that goes into space satellites. And there's a lot of R&D here that we're still doing to make these ever continuously improve that lithium ion. Key takeaways: we feel really strongly about our technology. We think that this multiple chemistry approach and approaching problems from the customer's view instead of from our scientist's view is the way to get us pulled into their development cycle, and that's how we get designed in. That's how we stay in for the long haul. We have a really solid core in our defense and aerospace, and notwithstanding what you're hearing about some of the government markets, the niche part is still there, and we've got a really strong backlog in that. We've got a very fast-growing medical product line that is maturing to the point that we're looking at it as an ongoing business instead of a startup. And we're very excited about our technology that we're bringing to these new markets and some of the applications that we've been able to garner so far in those areas, such as the buildings in New York. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you for the presentation.
Just to follow up, similar to the Vox question, or the magnetic technologies, what percent of your sales comes from products that have been developed in the last 5 years, and where do you see that going?
22%.
22%. And what was it a few years ago?
We weren't measuring it a few years ago. But I will tell you that 5-6 years ago, when I first came to Eagle Pitcher, we were up around 90% government legacy products and 10% commercial products, round numbers. And this year we're getting around 60-40. So we are changing the mix.
And then your platform is one of the more exciting ones within OM Group, given the high margins.
I think so, but I wouldn't say that to my colleagues. I respect them too much to go there.
And I guess the potential for growth from an investor perspective, unfortunately, it's one of the smaller ones as well.
Unfortunately.
Can you talk about what potential add-on acquisitions or technologies that you see out there, competitors, that might be interesting in terms of how big this business could be, given that you're going after what seems to be, you know, the higher end of the lithium-ion business? It's not a business that seems like it could be a $1 billion business. You know, where can this be?
So, those are very good questions. I believe that there are an increasing frequency of high-reliability applications that are occurring as people develop products that are more challenging to power. We're seeing that. And what we're seeing is that there are a lot of commercial engineering companies out there ill-equipped to try to take advantage of this. And so there are some large little packaging companies who get challenged, and they often fail. So there are some opportunities out there in the universe of these large engineering packaging companies that, if they were to be integrated with OM Group Bat Tech, we would have access to these opportunities, and we would be able to engineer higher value-added solutions on a going-forward basis. You had two parts to your question. Can you remind me of the second part? Okay, so you're right, but my point there is that I think that's increasing, and increasing in term of the percentage. It's very difficult to say. Some of the acquisition targets we've looked at have had pretty wild numbers, and ours is much more conservative, and I don't know where it's going to come out. It is happening. We're seeing it happen. We're seeing customers come to us who have tried the large packagers and they failed, and we're helping them package solutions that we didn't have before. The other part to your comment, though, that I remember now when you first asked the question was the acquisition opportunities. There's two classes. There's these large packagers who we can help through our value-added engineering, and then there is going to be some consolidation of the small guys in defense. They're not going to be able to withstand the downturn. There's too much competition. There's too much reduction in budget and so forth. So I think we're going to have a chance to consolidate and get some synergy out of some bolt-ons, even while OM Group Bat Tech approaches a large-scale acquisition to round out the platform in high-end commercial products.
Hi, Anna Nikolaevsky, Axel Capital Management. My first question is about what you're seeing currently in the utility stationary market,
mm-hmm.
and are you involved in that right now?
Very good question. And yes, we are involved. We're talking to some of the utilities. The utilities are not buyers right now. They are kicking the tires, so to speak. And so there's a number of demonstration projects. Most of those demonstration projects are put in at less than favorable margins because our competitors are buying their way into the demonstrations. That's why we built our own demonstrator, and we have toured several potential utility partners through our demonstrator. And it's a grid-scale demonstrator at 1 megawatt rate, 2 megawatt hours. It's respectable. We have sold to a utility, maybe two, if I remember correctly. But we've decided to take our focus off of the utilities and move toward this behind-the-meter market. We're going to keep watching the utilities for now because that could get really huge, and we think that our engineering and control algorithms are probably valuable as the utilities understand the advantages of the hybrid approach. This really was designed for a wind farm, and so what we were hearing. I was at lunch the other day with the guy who runs the utility that covers our area, and he said the whole secret to making wind work is you guys, and he pointed at me. So they know it's coming, but the FERC has to get in front of it with appropriate regulation so that the utilities can capture it in their rate base, and we're just starting to see the beginning of that.
But what we can do and what we are doing, what we're seeing is we're seeing that building owners, industrialists who see their electricity costs going up and up and up, if they can shave the peak, reduce their demand charges, there's an actual ROI to have for them to own this behind the meter.
Thank you. And given what Tesla is right now doing with its Gigafactory,
mm-hmm.
it looks like the demand for lithium will go up considerably
mm-hmm.
in the next several years. What is your expectation for lithium prices going forward, and what is the sensitivity to lithium pricing in your battery segment?
So if you'll remember back to 2008 when we started ARRA and then it went through 2009, 2010, there was a lot of press about how rare lithium was. And so a lot of people started going out and looking, and in fact, they found more lithium reserves than they thought were out there. And there's also ways of actually recapturing lithium from the ocean floor. I'm not concerned about lithium prices going up. I believe that lithium is a common enough element. This is my belief. I believe from what I've seen, the research I've done, that lithium is a common enough element that we're not going to see drastic prices. It's also there's a fair amount of lithium in a battery, but it's not like 80% of the material content. It's not a rare earth. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of pressure. Now, you've got to use that gigawatt factory for it to even start affecting demand, and so we'll see. We'll see how much that happens. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Okay, the next presentation is going to be electronic chemicals with Chris Vitale. You know, these next two businesses, Chris's business has been in the portfolio for, a longer period of time than our VOC business and our EPT business. So the next two presentations, we're going to try and get through the materials in your book, but we're running a little bit behind. But Chris and Devlin will attempt to present their material. Any questions, we'll still leave it open for that.
So good afternoon. My name is Chris Vitale, and I run the electronic chemicals business. And I get asked all the time, what is an electronic chemical? EC is all about innovation, and that innovation really affects our everyday life. We are a society that craves technology, whether it's our cell phones, our TVs, our automobiles, or our computers. The main two markets that we service are printed circuit boards and memory disks that go into hard disk drives. Our advantage in the marketplace is that we have patented technology, and probably even more important is know-how. The know-how is really important to us because we have to understand our customer's entire process. We have to understand their tanks, their pumps, their controllers, their environment in which they played in. Our future growth is really fueled by share gains, geographic expansions in Japan, Korea, and China, and market growth. So this is in simple terms, really represents how a printed circuit board is made. You've got your wafers and you've got your laminates. The laminates are actually layered together to make the actual printed circuit board, and the wafers are put into made into the chips. Those all get sent to an assembly house where the chips get put onto the board and ultimately go into the end products that we use every day. The most important thing to understand about what our job is to make the board conductive, corrosion resistance to prevent oxidation, and solderability of those chips to the board. As I mentioned at the beginning, our markets that we serve are constantly evolving. The products that we make have to change with the technology. In general, electronics are really becoming smaller, faster, smarter, and lighter. You know, in my house, I've got two teenagers. And it's awfully quiet in our house now because of cell phones. So my daughter's up in her bedroom, and she sends a text downstairs, says, "Dad, I'm hungry." So I send a note back upstairs, and I said, "Well, come down and get something to eat." So she sends me a note back, says, "Well, can't you bring me an apple and something to drink?" And I say, "No." So I get a in response. I used to think emails were bad because it really eliminated communication, but I think text messages could be worse. So our financial overview, as you can see, 80% of our entire business is really in Asia. When you look at the entire business for wet chemistries for printed circuit boards, 45% is done in China, 15% is done in Japan, and 11% in Korea. You can also see our total revenues have declined over the last few years. There's really three main reasons. The first, the biggest thing that we're plating is electroless nickel, and nickel prices have declined significantly over the last few years, from a high of about $50,000 to $15,000 today per ton. Nickel is a pass-through for us, and so it affects our total revenues. The second, we made a conscious decision to walk away from low-margin, commodity-type products. When we were talking earlier in the presentation, I'm one of the groups that's actually fired customers and walked away from very low-margin products. We have a choice to make on which markets we want to serve, and we've selected to grow profitably as opposed to top-end growth. And finally, as you saw on the products that ultimately get produced from electronic chemicals, they're consumer-driven. And so when the economy is soft and the job market, everybody's concerned about their jobs, people don't go out and buy that next-generation phone or a bigger TV. We have seven locations where we produce products, and as you can see, based on the demographic of where we do most of our business, which is in Asia, that's where the majority of our production and customer service facilities are located. A perfect example of this is in Kuching, Malaysia, which is our major memory disk producer, is directly across the street from one of our biggest customers. The closer you are to the customer, the better you are able to serve them. In the U.S., we mainly concentrate on our intellectual property protection and then manufacturing products for the United States and Europe. We participate in very attractive end markets. In memory disk, we're clearly the market share leader. The total market is about $75 billion, and it was a very mature business. This is a unique business that we play in because it was a mature business that was declining in volume. However, the last couple of years, it's found new life in what we call the cloud. And so as PCs started on the decline because of the iPads, a significant amount of the memory disk went away with that. But as the cloud came in, every time you take a picture, every time something gets downloaded into your phone, it goes to a cloud and gets stored. The more pictures you take, the more memory disks that we're going to sell. So the market is at about 600 million disks per year today, and now it's projected to grow at a rate of 5% a year. I was asked earlier about why aluminum substrate versus glass or solid state. Aluminum substrate is about 6 cents per gig. Glass is 14 cents per gig, and solid state is 90 cents per gig. So there's clearly an economic reason why we use aluminum substrate. In the printed circuit board, people can't wait to get the next gadget. I mentioned earlier, smaller, faster, smarter, more capabilities. The industry is constantly evolving. The wet chemistry part of this business, the part that we play in, is about $1.5 billion. It's a highly fragmented market, and we're a niche player at about an 8% global market share. As our end products change, so must our chemistries. So what's the main purpose in these markets? Again, for PCB, to make the board conductive, prevent oxidation, enable good solderability, basically make the board work. For memory disk, the EN, the electroless nickel, provides a non-magnetic, flat, defect-free coating, which is needed for the memory application. The aerial density of these disks has changed drastically over the years. The original disk, you could get about a 20 gig of memory on what's the size of a pizza. Today, on a 3.5-inch disk, we can get over 1 terabyte. Our chemistry supported this growth by providing a more defect-free, corrosion-resistant coating. So how do we deliver value? Our customers view us as the expert. Our know-how, as I started the discussion, is critical. Technical support, on-site engineering, and technical service centers so that we can do bath analysis and do troubleshooting for our customers. New product development really fuels our growth. I know the question's been asked a couple of times, so I'll answer it now. About 21% of our products, our total sales, comes from new products initiated over the last 5 years. That number really fluctuates somewhere between 20 to 25%, depending upon what comes out. A couple of examples of some products that clearly we have an advantage out in the marketplace. One is called Shadow, and Shadow is a product that is an offset to electroless copper plating. It offers several advantages. One, it's environmentally friendly. It's a tough word to say. But compared to electroless copper plating, it uses 80% less water. It can plate on anything from glass to plastic to about 50 different kinds of laminates. Faster plating times. Shadow can plate in 6 minutes versus electroless copper that could take up to 40 minutes. Enig is another one. It's a final finish for a printed circuit board. It's easy to control, and we don't have to use what's called dummy plating. There are other processes out there where a customer, when they start up a new bath, has to operate between 100 to 200 boards through that bath to activate it. We don't have to. It's our product can be done as active right when it starts. And new product development. Our new products in the pipeline really address the need for corrosion resistance, higher density. So these boards that we're printing or that we plate today, imagine to get more ability for out of these boards, you'd think that they would have to get bigger. But they're not getting bigger. They're getting thicker and smaller. What they're doing is they're putting more and more devices on these boards. So as the board gets thicker, a previous board might have 500,000 holes in it or vias. Today, we've got boards that have up to 2 million holes. So you can imagine how the technology, the plating technology, has to change to be able to plate a smaller surface with more holes. So our 2014 initiatives focus on our Chinese, Korean, and Japanese OEMs. As I mentioned, that represents 71% of our total business for the wet chemistries. We attack these markets through strategic partners and direct people going into those markets. We're growing in our high-profit, gross-margin products and limit the amount of time that we're spending on commodities. On our commercial and operations excellence, our initiatives are to improve the value of the low-margin products by raising prices, decreasing our costs through reformulation and sourcing, and finally, developing products that are regulatory compliant. So our key takeaways, know-how and intellectual property are critical to our success. We have to understand the complete processing capabilities of our customers so that we can help them troubleshoot. We're well-positioned in growth markets because this is a market that really requires change and almost constant change. By understanding our customers' future roadmaps and constantly evolving markets, we can help them meet their goals and meet their roadmaps through our existing and future technologies. So with that, do we want to take questions?
Yes.
Okay.
I have one quick question. What is the percentage of the commodity part of your operations?
I'd say the total part of commodities in the printed circuit board industry out of the $1.5 billion is probably a third of it, so about $500 million.
What about your part? It's getting less and less and less because we're moving away from the commodity type products. So the ultimate goal is to make those products profitable by raising prices and moving away from the commodity part of it. So well less than 10% for sure.
Hi, thank you. Can you talk about, you showed us sales, you didn't show us profitability a bit. I realize this is a subsegment of a segment.
That's right.
Can you give us a range of a sense, maybe better or worse? I mean, I realize you're in a tougher business than some of the other guys, but
the only
sense of what the goals are.
The only thing that I can say.
I guess I would say.
And is the goal then to manage this business for profitability as opposed to stronger growth versus others?
Yes. Thank you. Next will be Devlin Riley to talk about the advanced organic business.
Good morning, everybody. Again, Devlin Riley. I'm pleased to talk about our Borchers Additives business today. Hopefully give a little bit of education and fill you in a little bit on what our goals and objectives are. As Chris alluded to, the fact we are part of the advanced organics business, which is part of the specialty chemicals segment. So we are a leading supplier of performance differentiated additives to the coatings business. We typically play in the industrial coatings group, as well as industrial coatings segment, as well as high-end decorative coatings. We focus on these high-value markets because that's where we think we can create and capture value. We're able to solve our customer and the formulation problems and challenges that they have through using innovation, technology, and a regional service model, utilizing the greatest people in our business. So coatings are everywhere. In this picture alone, you'll see coatings on a car. You've got clear coat coatings on that car that utilize our products and our additives to produce a defect-free surface. You've got dispersants that we produce that are used to disperse the carbon black pigment in that car to make sure that it's a deep blue-black or a dark black color. You've got coatings on the exterior of the house, on the wood, on the doors, on the actual frame of the house itself that utilizes our Borchioxicoat. That Borchioxicoat technology allows the whiter color to be whiter longer. It allows you to cure it faster so you can paint more. It also allows you to replace other materials such as cobalt. Inside the house, you've got walls in the house that are coated with, that have coatings containing our additives that prevent sag lines, drips, defects, and bubbles. So this simple illustration kind of gives you an idea as to where we play in a typical can of paint. So the bottom component there, about 20%, is the carrier, the diluent. So it would be water or solvent. The next largest segment is are the pigments. That's probably the most valuable portion of the paint because it costs the most in terms of on a weighted average. The pigments obviously provide the color, hiding power as well. The next segment is called the resin or the binder. That is actually what provides some of the physical characteristics of the coating, so things like durability, adhesion. And then where we play in that top 5% is all on the performance additive side. It's a small percentage of the market, small percentage of the can of paint, but as you can see from the typical cost of each component, it brings a lot of value to that formulation as well. An example of this, as I mentioned earlier, on our regional service model. The region in the Americas is different than Europe, different than Asia. So one of the things that happens in the U.S. market and aftermarket is they utilize titanium dioxide slurries. Titanium dioxide, probably the most important pigment in any coating. And what happens is these are products that are formulated into storage tanks or tank wagons or rail cars, and they're shipped across the country or they're stored on site at a formulator or a coating producer. And what happens over time is the pigments start to settle out. And then what that means is you end up with rework, waste, additional cost, production downtime. As you can see from our Borchigen 1253, over time what happens is we're able to protect that settling effect and minimize that effect on the formulator and the producers. So not unlike the actual OM Group story, I think the story for our business is a great story of change as well. If you look at the very bottom section, it's more along the lines of kind of explaining what's our legacy business on the carboxylates and catalyst side, which is asset heavy, how we manage it and to try to manage it for efficiency, utilizing our assets, driving them as hard as we can, take out as much cost as we can. And as a result of that, in 2009, we went through a major restructuring where we consolidated manufacturing facilities, rationalized the product line, made some pretty tough decisions. Since then, we've continued to optimize the management and operation of that business. And in 2007, when we acquired the Borchers Additives business from, at that point, LANXESS, which was an original Bayer polyurethane technology, we've expanded that geographically. You'll see in a few slides it was very Eurocentric, and we're trying to expand that pie. In 2011, we acquired the Borchioxico technology from Rahu Catalytics. That is really what supercharged our business. That technology allowed us to bring something to the market that was IP protected, very new, nobody else has it. It performs best in any waterborne alkyd technology, and it really opened up the door for us to continue to sell other parts of our additives product line because we had already hooked into the technical and the R&D pipeline of our customers and the resin formulators and pigment companies. So it's really enabled us to do more with that technology. And since then, we've continued to innovate and launch new products. So I'd like to go through a couple examples right now. So the examples out on the table back and on the screen you see here are examples of metal coupons, so indicative of a metal substrate in most of your industrial coatings, whether it's a bridge or a tank or some other metal. And what you see is in the manufacturing process of these metals, they're used to have cleaners and oils and contaminants on them. So the customers that we have would choose not to have to take an extra step to clean the material and get it ready or prep for coating. So they like to use additives to wet the surface of that contaminated surface so that the coating actually applies, it adheres, and it provides the performance characteristics and coloring that you want. So you can see here between our 1375, the middle section with no additive at all, and against competitors A and B, we perform very well. And competitors A and B are the top two companies in the world on this. Again, our Borchigen 1350 is a great example for transparent iron oxides, which are used in wood coatings, used in automotive coatings, and you can see the transparency of the transparent iron oxide. The finer you can disperse it, the actual clearer the image becomes. It doesn't get hazy or cloudy. So on your wood coatings or anything else, you want to make sure you have something that's very transparent. And as you can see here, clearly we're a better choice. Mentioned earlier about the transition of our advanced organics business and how we've evolved. What this really represents is the portion of our business, my business, and the Borchers additive side is becoming a bigger part of our overall portfolio. So where do we make products? How do we service this on a regional model? Well, I'm based out of Westlake, Ohio, which is where our North American lab, application lab, and technical service group is located. Langenfeld, Germany is where we have our R&D headquarters, as well as in Castres, France, our manufacturing facility. And we also have a technical lab and application service group in Shanghai, China. And as you can see, the regions are slightly different. Not everything that goes on in Asia is going to be transferred to Europe or vice versa, or not everything in the U.S. transfers over as well. But because we have the experience in labs in all those regions, we can take advantage of any of those raw materials or pigment moves that take place from one region to another. We've already got ahead of the learning curve there. So where we participate in the value chain from a coatings perspective, it's kind of in that middle section between the formulators and the marketers. So the addressable market for coatings additives is around $4 billion. The overall coatings market is around $90 billion. Most of that, 60% of that around that, is around the decorative market. Decorative is highly competitive, highly commoditized. We focus only on the high-end applications there. In the industrial coatings segment, around 40%, that's really where our sweet spot is, where we play, utilizing our IP and trade secret technologies for our dispersants, our flow and leveling additives, rheology, and the like. So how do we deliver value to our customers? We utilize both pull and push strategies. From a push standpoint, we have direct salespeople that connect with our technical service representatives and engineers to provide application support. And what we do is we formulate with and for our customers. We test these formulations before they use them. We actually provide that kind of data so that they either validate or do additional testing with it to determine what they need. We also have a distribution channel globally that we use that has regional suppliers or regional distributors that work with our customers. They know the market as well as anybody. They probably already sell to these same customers that we're looking at. That's what we use to help service the smaller side of our market. And then finally, raw material suppliers, both on the resins and pigments that I showed. They represent about 75% of the total in-can formulation. The more we work with our resin companies and the pigment companies, we can actually get put on starting point formulations for their technical data sheets. So it kind of pulls through our name, our technology, our products. Doesn't guarantee us sales, but it certainly keeps our name in the game. And Borchioxy Coat is a great example of something we've used with multiple resin companies around the world that have been able to bring back resins from the grave that either couldn't dry or didn't perform as well as they were designed. So we've gotten a great opportunity there as well. So application-wise, we're into automotive, both OEM and refinish, aerospace and high performance, marine and protective, general industrial, as I said, is probably our majority there, wood coatings, and then high-end decorative. And you can see some examples of the customers that we participate with today. So what do customers buy from us? Well, simply, we have unique technologies and chemistries. They're applicable across a wide range of areas. So whether it's a waterborne coating, a solvent-borne, energy curable, 100% solids, powder coatings, we make additives that work in nearly all of them. So we have great brand name recognition specifically in Europe with high performance and also in Asia as well. We're trying to boost that brand recognition here in the Americas. We also develop the best alternatives for regulatory changes or anticipation of regulatory changes, and I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. And then finally, most of our additives are engineered to be universal, meaning that they can be used in all those different chemistries simultaneously. What that means is it allows the formulator and the customer more flexibility to use our products across a wider range of chemistries. So as I mentioned, regulatory drivers and other growth drivers for our business. If someone wants to move away from cobalt-free, whether it's in Europe or here or anywhere else in the world, we've got the Borchioxy Coat technology that they can utilize along with other platforms. If they want to get away from conflict minerals like tin, we've got a full BorchiCat product line of catalysts. If they want to move away from methyl ethyl ketoxine materials, we've got our ASIN and anti-skin product lines that help stabilize the skinning in the can. Waterborne alkyds are moving into more applications. Why is that important? That's our Borchioxy Coat. We work really well on that system. It's the best alternative for that, for drying those resins. And then the movement toward waterborne coatings globally is also beneficial for our environmentally friendly solutions that we provide as well, also being 100% solids application. And then finally, the coatings market in general is growing around 5%. As you can see, we're kind of a Eurocentric business as well. We've seen and expanded the growth in both Asia and in the Americas markets, though, and we expect that to continue. The good news is the markets in both of those regions are similar to size to what we have in Europe, so we've got opportunities there. And the fact that the coatings additives market as well as coatings markets are both fairly fragmented, it does provide us additional opportunities. In the applications that I listed earlier, the top 3-4 customers represent maybe 30 to 35% of the total. So it's very fragmented. It provides us some good opportunities. So initiatives our business has. First, we're going to optimize our regional model, and we're going to do it on a global basis. What that means is we've got to expand in both the Americas and Asia, and then continue to work on our sourcing and manufacturing options, both through acquisitions as well as internal initiatives. Secondly, we're going to continue our Borchioxy platform growth, and what that means is we're going to continue to work this product through as many of the formulations that we can on the resin side, but we're also going to continue to push this through customized formulations for individual customers. And then finally, as the rest of the group has mentioned, we also have considerable operational, commercial, and innovation initiatives by reducing costs, maximizing our profitability, allocating the resources, as I said earlier, to expand our business in Asia and the Americas, develop and launch new products, as our vitality index for our business is around 17%. We need to move that up. And by doing that, we're going to select those products based on rigorous our ability to drive profit and value, not just for us, but for our customers as well. So takeaways, I want to let you know that I think our coatings additives business, we solve customer problems and formulator challenges with our technology and our innovation. The coatings market is attractive because it's very fragmented. It gives us plenty of opportunities to participate. We're improving our market share position both in Asia and in the Americas with considerable upside. And we can win by anticipating regulatory changes ahead of our competition. And with that, I will open the floor up. It's been a long morning. Thanks for hanging in there.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Just so overall, just so I can get a sense, if the specialty chemicals business is $319 million and the business we just saw was $139 million, leaves $180 million left. How big is Borchers? Because I don't think it's that. It's not $180 million, is it?
No, it's about half of the balance of the Advanced Organics Group.
So 90-ish million dollars. Okay, great. And then this slide on 114 where you show the coatings additive sales by region, Europe 65%, America's 15%, Asia 20%. That's not your breakup, right? That's the overall industry breakup?
No, that's our breakup.
That's
of
yours.
The Borchers additives business, yes.
So,
correct.
So to your point of how you're going to grow in the Americas out of Ohio, can you talk about is it customer acquisition or is it buying other smaller niche competitors that can get you into the customer?
Maybe a little of both. When we look at our acquisition, what our pipeline looks like, it's a combination. We have maybe some portfolio gaps we'd like to fix and address, but also it's really just getting our name out more in the Americas market. Quite honestly, we work our legacy business. We've been a major key supplier to all the major coating companies on our dryer side of our business. And so when we introduced the Vorcia OxyCoat technology that really kind of kickstarted things for us, it opened up the formulation doors and the R&D doors to those companies that previously we hadn't really paid attention to because a majority of those dryers were commodity-based materials. So it was based on relationships. So we still think there's plenty of upside in terms of just working with our customers on specific projects. And once we get a chance to earn their business back and they see the credibility and the fact that we can do it, we'll get more opportunities.
Since you are you have a very large portion of your operations in Europe, could you talk about, generally speaking, what you see in terms of recovery in construction and other markets that you may be involved in there? Because it looks as though you have not really benefited from the housing recovery in the U.S. since you are so small, or maybe you did have.
That we haven't, I'm sorry. That we
benefited from the U.S. the housing recovery in the U.S.? So if you could touch on both.
Sure. Most of the housing business is really the architectural or the decorative side of the business, so we're not really a major player there. We're on the high end of the decorative business. So we wouldn't expect to see major pull-through in the from a boost of 5 to 7% in the commercial scale of construction. Europe, the last 2 years have been a really tough 2 years, both on the weather side of things as well as the business from an economic standpoint. We're seeing some recovery in that this year already with fairly strong demand. We expect and hope that that continues. And then the growth again in the construction market from a U.S. perspective, that will pull through some of the lower end parts of the business, but we don't expect that to be a major influence in terms of our performance. Our performance is really going to be getting involved in the new applications and producing results that are commensurate with higher value applications where we solve problems.
We're seeing Vorcia Oxy actually go into new formulations. Because oftentimes if you put something into an existing formulation, it kicks out some other parameter. So we're seeing some real momentum now on that side of it.
Can I just bring it back to overall OM group? Just to
sure.
Ask a question? Okay.
Absolutely.
So just a quick, I know your guidance for the year is, what, $130 to $140 million in EBITDA? And I assume that, like other companies, industrial companies, maybe you could talk about this, how the first quarter weather has impacted your business at all. I realize a lot of your business is done in the second and third quarter, but maybe just speak a little bit to how the year is starting out, given the bad weather in North America.
Yeah, we're really not impacted by weather. You know, it's typically architectural coatings would be and. I think there's some talk perhaps that automotive sales have lagged, somewhat due to weather-related issues. However, we're seeing, we're more involved right now in the manufacturing process side, industrial manufacturing strength and the like. So the weather, in particular, hasn't really been a big impact. Are there any other? Yes, Rosemary.
Looking at your pyramid, I was wondering where do you stand today in that?
Great. I was
in the blues.
when you look at that pyramid, quite frankly, you know what our aspiration is. Clearly the aspiration is to move up. But I will tell you, Rosemary, we're somewhere right now in the middle of that. And depending on the product line, like you could look at Vorcia Oxy, and the Borsiaxy product line is in the, you know, proprietary part of that pyramid. You could look at some of our other product lines and say they're probably a little bit lower in that pyramid. So I would say on average we're somewhere right around in the middle right now, but clearly aspiring to move up. Great. Thank you. Ivan.
Just a quick question. Back to the M&A.
Sure.
So we've talked about this for years, and we've done these platforms where the Rockwood Electronics Eagle Pitcher back. So now they've all been in the portfolio for a couple of years, and we've talked about doing bolt-on acquisitions, yet there really hasn't been any done outside of maybe Borchers, if you want to count that. So what is changing today that, or in the recent change, that these acquisitions are going to be able to be completed, or you're going to be able to grow this business, you know,
yeah,
with the M&A strategy? Because, I mean, we've been looking, in theory, been looking
correct
the past several years. So what's different?
Yeah. So the question is, you know, on the M&A strategy, you know, given that, you know, Borchers and, you know, the original, you know, Plaschem, for example, were synergistic, what's changed, Ivan, is the culture of the company, the leadership of the company, the drive and desire of our and the talent of our leadership teams. I mean, we clearly are shifting from an M&A initiated focus being more at the, you know, the highest parts of the business. For example, in order to buy VOC and Eagle Pitcher, you know, that really took place with me and Greg and the senior leadership team playing the biggest role in laying down those platforms, which we had to do to unlock the value, that trap value inside the company. What's absolutely different today is the men and women in the company and the people you see in the leadership side here. I mean, we just came out of a leadership conference. We spent 3 days with our top leaders of the company. There is no doubt that we got a message down to our leaders about what our expectations are and what we need to do. So I will tell you, though, when you say nothing has happened up to this point, I think there was a statement made before. We've been working really, really hard on the M&A side, but we're being very, very disciplined. There were two or three transactions that we got pretty close to, and then we didn't like what we saw, either in the form of what the valuation was demanding of us or of our detailed due diligence. So I will tell you that we are very prudent in how we're looking at our investors' capital right now. You could be assured of that. And in the whole idea of our desire, we have a strong desire to add to these platforms, as our business leaders do. I mean, there's properties right now that they covet dramatically, but it's our process is disciplined. So that's the answer. Absolutely. You know, I could say, you know, listen, who knows what could happen here. I would say that, you know, with what our deal pipeline looks like right now, there's a high probability that there could be a small transaction. When I say small, we talked about that range being, you know, somewhere 10 to 200 perhaps. But I would say that there's a very high probability that you'll be hearing something out of us within the next 12 months. Very high. Any other questions? Okay, I'm sorry.
Just curious, you know, you mentioned on one of your slides, slide 17, about the expectation to grow sales 5% annually over a course of a normal business cycle, which I know you've discussed in the past as well, but just kind of curious, especially since some of the platforms haven't been around, you know, only a couple of years or so, where are we at in terms of that cycle? You know, 50% of the sales are in Europe. That seems to be bottoming out and possibly improving. So where are we at in terms of that cycle? And, you know, would you expect to grow above that over the next couple of years as it's been challenged the last couple, particularly because of Europe?
Yeah, I think we are seeing recovery right now. You know, we're not ready to declare victory in Europe. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty, especially with what's going on in Eastern Europe right now. You know, who knows what that could cause. But we are seeing, you know, when we talk about 5% over a cycle, we clearly mean over a cycle. So typically, you know, we could see a year where things recover. We could see a little bit higher than that. But we do see the troughs and the peaks in that.
Yeah.
So,
go
ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that, Kevin. You know, that 5% is an aggregate, you know, across the entire business. You got to keep in mind, you know, automotive systems has done very well, defense has done well, medical. So just remember that 5% is an aggregate across the enterprise.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, before we break up, you know, I just want to end this session, first of all, by saying thank you. to every one of you for your interest, for being here today. It really means a lot to us to have, you know, the interest in our company. And there's a lot of very familiar faces out there. And with all the familiar faces, you know, one thing I did want to say, you know, especially I look at Rosemary, and we've come to your conferences. We've been to Boston at KeyBank. We've traveled with you, Chris. You know, when you think about our company, you know, and you think about, you know, I can't tell you how excited I am right now. And I said at the beginning that there was never a doubt in my mind that we would transform the company. And you think about where we were, you know, talking about a nickel mine, a laterite nickel mine in Australia. That was our company. When I joined, we were transporting incredibly high-cost nickel all the way to Harjavalta, Finland for refining with no competitive advantage at all. We had nothing. We had nothing to offer to the world except nickel. Then we had our cobalt. Today, what we're standing here in front of you talking about exposure to aerospace, exposure to medical. You know, we're actually mitigating the effects of Parkinson's disease. You know, people that have tremors today. I'm on the board of the Cleveland Clinic, and I saw a video of someone who was at an advanced stage with Parkinson's. They couldn't walk. They got deep brain stimulation, neuromodulation with the St. Jude unit. This individual was walking. And when you think about, you know, what we're doing to make the world a better place by exposure to aerospace, medical, defense, renewable energy, automotive, you know, we've totally transformed this company. And, you know, I have to tell you that we've got a leadership team now that is augured into doing the next phase of what we need to do. And with that in mind, you know, I wanted to share with all of you, we just came back from Orlando, Florida, and I stood up in front of 90 of our top leaders, and I talked about our culture. Because one of the things that, when you look at us, you have to consider, you're buying a leadership team. At the same time, you're looking at our product line. You know, product lines are important. You know, we've got batteries, you know, for neuromodulation. But what you have to look at are the behaviors that exist. And I just wanted to read you the list of what I talked about. You know, I won't go through all of them, but these are the values that we hold dear, you know, in our company. You know, we talked about loving what we do. We have to really do that. We talked about setting high expectations, you know, for our leadership team. You know, every one of us, when we look at our business lives, the way we budget, the way we lead, the way we want to grow our company, the way we want to improve our value, what we're saying to you is that we're setting high expectations. We approach one of the values we have is to approach obstacles as opportunities. You know, adversity, we say adversity is a good thing. It's our friend. You know, we really believe that. It makes every one of us better. If we think about our personal lives, I think about my personal life. Anytime I've had a hurdle, it's made me a better person. Businesses are no different. So these obstacles that we're confronting right now, we look at as a value that we hold dear. And we actually, you know, I have to tell you, we're embracing that. We're not afraid of it. We're not afraid of bad markets. We're not afraid of demanding customers. We're not afraid of training our people to go out there and look at how we're gaining value from our product line. This next value is an important one that all of you need to recognize. The promises we make are the promises we deliver. Promises we make are the promises we deliver, and that value really is extending not only, you know, where we talk about that as a personal thing that we all aspire to, but when we look at our business people, we want them to understand that commitments are commitments. So we make a commitment to our investors to do the kind of things that we want to do. We're going to carry that through. It permeates the entire company. And these are our words. These are words that we're saying to our people and values that are part of our company. Being highly optimistic is one of our guiding principles. Always recognize the power of informal leadership. Now, you may wonder what that's all about. You know, I believe that titles are given, you know, they're given to all of us. You know, I was given a title of CEO. David is our president. We have a CFO. But one of the cultures of our company that we're really driving is that true performance and power comes from the informal side of leadership, how we communicate with each other. Control freaks probably will not succeed in our environment because controlling leadership prevents people from getting around that, and you can't unleash the power of your people. So, you know, one of the things that we are training our people on is that we have to communicate, we have to be better listeners, and that's a value in our company right now. Respect your fellow associates. This goes back to this value that we have about, you know, making sure that we're listening to our people. And the last, well, there's two other ones, but the one value is that our egos are in check. And the best leaders have their egos in check. And I will tell you that arrogance will get people fired in our company. And we're never going to be an arrogant company. We're going to be a confident company. We're going to be a company that's proud of what we can do. We're a company that's going to believe in our accomplishments, but we're never going to get out ahead of ourselves, and we're never going to believe our press clippings. I could assure you of that. And we're one team. You know, we're creating a big team here. So I thought that was important to mention to all of you because, you know, it's real easy for us to get up here and talk about batteries, and, you know, that's the easy part of what we do. But I think one of the things when I get asked in our investor meetings by an analyst or an investor, you know, what is it? What are we missing? You know, what are we not asking you? What are we not? What may we be missing in terms of our models and our analysis? You know, business is still made up of people. You know, if you didn't need people, you know, you'd have these PCs doing program decisions. Decisions aren't programs. You know, business in many ways is still very personal, no matter where the technology goes. So I think it's really important that, you know, and I know you don't miss these things because you look at people, you look at their their energy level, and I will tell you that that we are really full of energy right now, and we want to deliver. So thank you again for being here and all your great interest.